This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Thomas Ray. Today is May 13, 2010. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mr. Ray is joining me by phone from Alabama. Okay, why don't we begin? If you could tell me a little bit of biographical information about yourself. First of all, when and where were you born?
I was born in Montgomery, Alabama. And July 19th, 1950.
All right. Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about your parents? What were their names, and what did they do for a living?
My father was a physician.
Okay.
Dr. James C. Ray, and my mother was a registered nurse.
Mm-hmm. All right. All right. Did you grow up there in Alabama?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
And, I grew up in Laverne, Alabama.
All right. All right. Could you tell me, I guess, just a little bit about growing up and what that was like for you there in Laverne?
Well, I actually grew up in the country.
Okay.
Pretty much, you know, and, you know, we had horses and all of that. Pretty much grew up on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And in the rural area. Laverne's a town with about, I think, around 2,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a small town. Upbringing.
Right. All right. So did you grow up then doing a lot of work on the farm and that kind of thing? Or?
Yeah, I did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Worked on the farm, had horses around.
Right.
Rode horses a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff like that. But usually in the summer, working on the farm, you know, gathering up hay and stuff like that. And we also had a farm, had cows, pigs, and grew some crops.
Mm-hmm.
There also.
All right. All right. Well, as a kid growing up there, did you have any interest in the military as a kid? Any relatives who had served in the military?
Yeah, my father was in World War II.
Okay.
And my uncle was also. Great grandfather and great great grandfather were in the Civil War.
Okay, so a long background of service then.
Yeah, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did your dad ever talk much about what he did in World War II?
No, he really didn't. I have you know, some pictures that he had from back then and a few things that he brought back, but he didn't really, you know, talk about it that much.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, given the fact that you had this military background, as a kid growing up, were you interested in it yourself? Did you think about one day you'd probably be in the military too? Or,
well, yeah, actually I did. In fact, I went. I actually volunteered
mm-hmm.
in 1969, just right out of high school.
Okay,
I think I'd been out of high school about a month, and instead of going to college, I just went ahead and joined the military.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, before we get into the Army, if we could talk just a little bit about education and school. Where'd you go to high school?
I went to high school at Laverne High School.
Mm-hmm.
Graduated in 1969.
All right. Excuse me. Well, as a kid growing up there again, did you pay much attention to what was going on in the world with the Cold War and U.S. foreign policy?
Well, not really.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't. You know, I knew that the Vietnam War was going on. We had a few people, you know, from the county there that had been killed over there.
Mm-hmm.
Other than watching it on the news and stuff, that was about it. I didn't really, you know, get into foreign policy or anything.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, watching it on the news there and hearing that some of the local guys have been killed in the war, did you have much of an opinion about it at that point? Did you think much about why we were there and those types of issues?
You know, really, I didn't at that age.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't have an opinion on it. I don't think anybody can really, think about exactly how it's going to be or anything else. It's kind of a, you know, when you go in the Army, you don't really know what to expect. You know,
mm-hmm.
you don't know the good and the bad. You just say, you know, I'm in the Army. But I really didn't have an opinion, you know, as far as I wanted to be in the military, but, you know, I guess I was more of a pro-Army more than I was anti, I guess, being from the South.
Right.
So.
All right. Well, what was it then that that made you decide to join? Was it to keep up that family tradition, or was there, was that part of it, or was there more to it? Or?
You know, just thinking back, I'm not, you know, I could think back some on it. I really just didn't know what to do at that point in my life. So I pretty much just went ahead and I joined the Army, knowing that, you know, I could at least serve, you know, in the Army until I really found out what I really wanted to do.
Right.
So I was kind of unsure about what to do with my life.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, when you did make that decision to join, did you figure that with Vietnam had been going on for a while at this point, you knew that you would probably be going to Vietnam?
Yeah, I figured it. I really didn't care one way or the other.
You know? Okay.
That didn't really bother me.
Right. All right. Well, what did your family think about your decision to join?
They weren't too pleased about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, they knew I was going to do whatever I wanted to do anyway, so there wasn't too much I could do about it. But they weren't, I mean, they were supportive, but they really weren't crazy about me joining the Army at that time, for sure.
Right, right. Well, you mentioned you volunteered in 1969.
Right.
Of course, 68, the big year with Tet and all that chaos and things going on at that point. Did you follow that fairly closely?
I followed it a little bit, but I don't know if I could really comprehend how bad it really was over there.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I did.
Okay.
You know, yeah.
All right. Well, could you talk a little bit about the process of enlisting and how that worked for you?
Boy, you're asking me stuff that's a long time.
Sorry.
If I can remember all of it.
Sure.
Well, I actually went to Montgomery. I guess they called it the H&R Point. Of course, you go, you know, through the physicals and stuff, walk around with your underwear and your shoes on while they're doing your physical and stuff. And just from that, I guess, I was just sworn in at that point. And they just had a whole line of us, of course, you know, with regular Army plus the ones that were draftees. And, of course, there were a lot of people trying to get out of it, for sure.
Right.
Being draftees. And I think they all lined us up about, I don't know how many people there were lined up there, and toward the end of it, after we swore in, then they counted off about 10 on one end of the row there and said, pointed them off and said, "Congratulations, you've just joined the Marine Corps." And they said, "I thought this was voluntary," and they said, "Yep, you just did, you volunteered."
Right.
So that's kind of, but that's pretty much it after we were sworn in. And I was, you know, we got on a bus and I went to Fort Benning, Georgia.
Okay.
For basic training.
So you went to basic immediately then after enlisting?
Well, yeah, I was on a delayed entry program.
Okay.
Which, delayed it a little while before you went in, about 2 or 3 months. And then at that point, then we went up there and went to Fort Benning, Georgia.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Could you talk a little bit about your basic training and what the experience was like for you as a new guy coming into the Army?
Yeah. Well, it was pretty eye-opening there. When we first got there on the bus, you know, and everybody goes through there, and I guess they issue all your clothes and stuff, and you're sitting there lugging around a couple of duffel bags, and I think the bus pulled up, and you got about 3 big drill sergeants hollering at you, and ran off the bus, and I think the first thing they did was they made us crawl under the buildings over there. They said there was a snake under there, and they wanted all of us to crawl under the buildings over there. It was one of the old World War II barracks.
Right.
And they told us to crawl under the building and don't come out unless somebody caught that snake that went under there. Jeez, man, it's going to be kind of rough here.
Right.
But basically, it was pretty rough, pretty physically challenging for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Mentally, I didn't have too much problem in basic. You know, I could pretty much do everything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we did have people in there that I guess had never been hunting or never did anything. It was pretty rough on them,
mm-hmm.
you know, the change. But it wasn't that bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, you mentioned people that had never been hunting and things. With your, I guess, your background of growing up in the country, as you said, did you think that helped you in some ways then?
Yeah, it definitely did.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, there was quite a few people from the South and from the country and stuff, and we'd been hunting. We knew how to handle weapons and kind of knew how to shoot. Of course, they're going to teach you how to shoot right.
Right.
But, yeah, that I would say that definitely helped out. You can really see the difference in the ones that had been raised up in the country or, you know, had been hunting and stuff like that, rather than the ones that were raised in the cities and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
There was definitely a difference in that.
All right. Okay. Well, could you talk, I guess, a little bit about just what the daily routine was like there at BASIC, or a typical day?
In BASIC.
Mm-hmm.
Goodness, let me see if I can remember.
Sure.
I think a typical day usually, well, it started before the sun came up. Of course, you know, you really didn't have to worry about what time it was. They were going to tell you to do everything, so you pretty much,
mm-hmm.
you didn't have to keep up with what time it was or anything. But as far as I can remember, the first thing we did in the morning, you'd usually do physical training as far as running and stuff like that, and just your basic soldiering skills,
mm-hmm.
you know, drill and ceremony, stuff like that. And it was, it was typical basic training, more or less, to, you know, you break everybody down to where everybody's thinking as one,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to work as a team. And I think that's most of the stuff they were trying to teach in basic training.
All right. How about your drill instructors there? Could you talk a little bit about them? For one thing, were they Vietnam vets?
Yes, all of them were.
Okay.
The three that we had were Vietnam vets, and they were also, I think all three of them were Rangers.
Okay.
Ranger qualified.
Mm-hmm.
They're pretty tough and pretty stern, but they really knew their stuff. I was impressed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were very good.
Right. How did they enforce discipline, if there or were there discipline issues, and if there were, how did they enforce them?
There weren't a whole lot of discipline issues, but of course back then, you know, there was no thing. It's not like it is today. They could actually put their hands on you or do whatever they wanted to, so
mm-hmm.
they could pretty much enforce discipline any way they wanted to.
Right.
You know, I remember we had a we actually had a coal-fired heater for heat and for hot water.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually had to have somebody up all night to make sure that they shovel coal in there so that we would have heat and hot water. And there was a little room over there, and usually the drill sergeant would take somebody in there if he had any problems.
Right.
And they also had what they called a motivational platoon.
Okay.
I have no idea what they did there, but when they went there, when they came back, they were definitely different people. So,
all right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you mention the fact that they were all three Vietnam vets and that they were all Ranger qualified? Well, did they ever talk about their experiences at all in Vietnam? Did they ever mention Vietnam during the training?
No, not really, mm-hmm. other than, you know, the chance that you do, you know, when you're marching and stuff like that, talking about Vietnam. But as far as a one-on-one conversation,
right.
You really didn't have that with the drill sergeants.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, they were the instructor, and they were pretty much, they were way up here, and you were way down at the bottom. So you didn't really have a one-on-one
right.
Talk with them or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, how about the weapons training? Could you talk a little bit about that and what type of weapons you were trained on there in basic?
When I went through basic, I guess we were the last group that went through with the M14.
Okay.
I never touched the M16 until I got to AIT.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually went through the rifle marksmanship and everything with the M14.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as that, I mean, as far as teaching you how to fire and everything else and how to shoot and everything, they were very good instructors.
Right.
On that, you know, it was, I shot expert with M14.
Okay.
Shooting it. It was quite a change going to the M16.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
All right. Well, overall, did you feel that the training you received there in basic, was it sufficient as far as preparing you for, I guess, life in the Army?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, they kind of teach you what to expect, you know, day to day, and I think it's just like it is. It's just a basic introduction to the Army, to the Army way, you know, before you go to advanced training and stuff. But yeah, I would say yes. I mean, as far as that, you know, I don't know as far as preparing you to go to war or something, but they pretty much prepared you for just the basic Army life, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So did you feel that you were adjusting to the military pretty well at that point?
Yeah, I adjusted fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really have any problems.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, before moving on from basic to AIT, were there any particularly memorable moments, humorous moments, anything like that stick out in your mind that you could possibly mention?
Gosh, I can't think of any. It wasn't very humorous.
Sure.
Humorous 8 weeks.
Right.
But I know, I don't know if it's humorous or not, but we would be so tired at night, I mean, you know, physically tired, that, of course, we were in the old double bunks and everything, and I remember one guy was so tired he couldn't get up and go to the bathroom, so he wet the bed that night.
Oh, no.
He was so physically exhausted he couldn't even get up, and I was going, oh, God.
Mm-hmm.
But it was pretty tough, basic training was back then. It's completely changed from what it was back then.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, at the end of basic there, was that when you received your MOS at that point?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. At the end of basic, what you did is they would call everybody in, and they would pretty much tell you where your AIT was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a long line of people, and they would go in there, and they would tell you pretty much where you were going.
Mm-hmm.
And from then, you pretty much knew where you were going after your MOS.
Right.
You know, they would say something like Fort Dix or somewhere else like that. The majority of us were going to Fort Polk for infantry training.
Okay.
That's pretty much, I would say, probably at least 75% or probably more were going to Fort Polk, Louisiana for basic.
Okay.
AIT.
All right. Okay. Was that, forgive me, I can't remember, but was that where the Tigerland was as well?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
That's where I went.
All right. Okay. Well, could you talk a little bit about AIT and the type of training you received there and your experiences there?
Well, it was just we just received our basic infantry training and stuff, tactics, techniques and stuff as far as for infantry training.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to think what, you know, I really think AIT is, it just gives you, it's more of a basic, because it really doesn't prepare you as far as going to Vietnam or to war. I mean, it, I guess it helps some, but I mean, it's a whole different thing. When you get over there, you pretty much gotta try to learn on your own.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a different thing. I guess it's stuff that they really can't teach you there. we did have some good instructors, you know, in different things like patrolling and stuff like that. But it's, you know, as far as once you got over there, it was just completely different. You just learned from somebody over there.
Okay. All right. So this time during AIT, was it primarily training in the field, or was there classroom training as well, or how did that work?
Yeah, we had classroom training on basic first aid, communications. You know, at that time we had the old PRC 77 and 25s, and you learned about that, how to, you know, different stuff like that. We had some weapons training.
Mm-hmm.
What else we had? Of course, we go to the field, you know, dig in the foxholes and have your aggressors coming against you while you're out there. And we had some identification, I think, with camouflage, had training on camouflage.
Mm-hmm.
We also had the, I can't remember what it was called, but it was, it's like a quick reaction course.
Mm-hmm.
Where we went through there with BB guns. You were supposed to shoot stuff real, real fast, I guess, and that was to, I guess, to get you used to, you know, a quick fire light,
mm-hmm.
which is what a lot of stuff would happen in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
Other than that, we had an escape and evasion course where they would set you out, and you had to go from this point to that point, and they had aggressors out there that would actually capture you. Take you to a POW camp if they caught you, and
mm-hmm.
then you went through. Well, they had a little torture. They put you through different things to see if you would talk or
mm-hmm.
whatever.
What, if you don't mind me asking, what type of things would they do to try to, you know, to prepare you and to, you know, see if they could get you to talk?
Well, one of the things was it was actually a type of waterboarding.
Okay.
You know, they would tie you down and pour water on your face and stuff, and you know, they would ask you like, who's your commanding officer? They did one where it was called an Apache pole, and they would stick you on a pole with your knees stuck out, and they'd come around and step on your knees and bring them down. I mean, it was you know, I actually made it all the way through. Almost to the end, and I got I slipped on a road and fell down, and I got captured and taken to the POW camp.
Mm-hmm.
And I went through, I think it was three or four of those little torture sessions they have with them.
Right.
And but I escaped. I escaped from the POW camp.
All right.
So, but it was pretty intense. I remember thinking, I said, you know, this can't be too bad because we're all in the Army. And I had second thoughts about that after I'd been there a little while,
because
they would actually, it was pretty rough.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, they would use their fists on you, they would use whatever. I think they had one guy had a dislocated shoulder, one guy almost broke his leg, I think.
Mm-hmm.
They had some that they had to take to the hospital after that.
Right.
So it got pretty rough. I think not too long after that, they had a congressional investigation on that. Because they had too many people hurt or whatever.
Right.
You know, they were beat up and everything else. So.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, do you remember how you escaped?
Yeah. They actually had me on an Apache pole and had my hands tied, and I got my hands loose.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, I think it was a corporal. He was the one that had been torturing me on the pole there.
Mm-hmm.
And he had walked off or something. They just left me there. And I got my hands loose,
and right.
Finally got my legs untied so I could stand up, and so I just waited till he had his back turned, and there was a 2x4 laying over there, and I picked up a 2x4 and hit him as hard as I could right between the shoulder blades,
right,
and jumped over the fence and escaped. Picked up a big stick and said, "I'll just beat somebody to death before I go back there." Cause I heard them hollering for me.
Right.
You know, they were just about everybody out there hunting for me, but they never did find me. And then the next day, I finally made my way back to the to the company area.
Mm-hmm.
So.
What was their reaction to your escape?
Well, they had everybody out there looking mm-hmm. for me, but they weren't going to find me, that's for sure. Or they were going to get beat with a stick once.
Right. So nothing was said after that, after you got back?
No, our company commander there came through there, and when they would take you through the different stations mm-hmm. to see if you would talk, they would mark on your face with either like a little star or something, to say that, yeah, he'd gone through that one, and they'd take you to the next station, and then they would mark on your face that you'd made it through that without talking, and they'd take you to the third one, which would get a little rough every time.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was either my third or fourth station, and when I got back, I still had those marks on my face, and I guess they had let the word out, about that I'd hit that guy with a... And the company commander came by and just kind of looked at me and said, I guess you're the one they're looking for. I guess so, sir. But wasn't anything done anyway.
Right, right. All right. Well, I know you talked about in basic you had trained on the M14 and had never touched it. Never touched the M16 prior to coming to AIT. Once you made that transition, what did you think about the M16? Could you make a little comparison between the two and what you thought about them?
Well, after firing the M14 and moving to the 16, it was like going from a rifle to a toy,
mm-hmm.
Because it was so much lighter and everything. We really didn't think a whole lot about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only time we ever even fired it, I don't even think we ever zeroed or anything. I think we just went out there and fired it a little bit on automatic, and that was about it. That was my qualification with it until I got overseas.
Mm-hmm.
We really didn't have any type training on it or, that much at all.
Mm-hmm.
And once we got overseas, of course, that's what we were issued.
Right.
And we didn't know a whole lot about them
mm-hmm.
as far as cleaning or how to zero them or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
But the M14 is a by far superior weapon. But, I understand, the ammunition weighs so much more, plus the magazines, and the M14 weighs a lot more than the M16. So I can see why they went to it, but...
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I know you said that AIT was an introduction basically to the infantry and didn't really prepare you for Vietnam, but was it supposed to be focused that way to where it was to prepare you for Vietnam? I guess what I'm asking is, did they talk a lot about Vietnam? Did they mention a lot? Did they reference Vietnam a lot or not?
Yeah, it was pretty much referenced the whole time we were there because they knew anybody that was coming there was going over there. They call it Little Vietnam over there.
Okay.
At Tigerland. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's essentially what they were training you for, but I guess as far as the tactics and techniques that they were teaching, some were okay, but, I mean, as far as really preparing somebody, I don't think you really could compare, that type training to what you were going to have once you got into Vietnam. It was pretty much different. Mm-hmm. I think most of your training is going to be like what they call OJT, or on-the-job training.
Okay.
So you pretty much got trained once you got to Vietnam.
Right. Not to get too far ahead here, but did you go through, what they call a charm school of sorts when you got there, or...
What do you mean, like?
A little bit of training in Vietnam before you actually really went out in the field, or was it actually just you got there and you went out in the field?
No. Just as soon as we got there, we went to the field.
Okay.
Of course, my first job over there was burning everybody's where they went to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because the unit was out in the field at the time, so I had to wait till they got back before we went out.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually, I think it was maybe three of us were there waiting till they got back before we went out on the next mission.
Okay. All right. Well, before we actually get into Vietnam, I guess a few more questions about your AIT there. As I asked with with BASIC. Any particularly memorable moments during AIT that stick out in your mind?
Actually, infantry AIT is pretty much, it's about the same as basic training. I mean, there's not a whole lot of changes there. There's still a lot of physical challenges, mental challenges. As far as that, I think the only things I can think of was after AIT, when, you know, right at the end of AIT, when they were on leave, they had a couple of people that we heard went AWOL, you know, left because he didn't want to go to Vietnam.
Right.
That one guy that actually shot himself in the leg, or got his girlfriend to shoot him in the leg to keep from going. You know, so it was, I think everybody was coming to the realization of where they were going after that.
Right. So then everyone that you went through AIT with, did they all end up going to Vietnam, with the exception of those guys who tried to circumvent that?
Yeah, I would think so. If you went to Fort Polk, you pretty much were going to Vietnam, unless you were in the National Guard or Reserves.
Right, okay.
That's the only ones that didn't. Mm-hmm. You know, back then, you were actually an individual, what they call an individual augmentee, so may or may not see anybody that you knew in AIT, because once you got to Vietnam, you were just, they took individuals and stuck them in units.
Right.
You didn't really go with, you know, as a group or anything. But so I really didn't follow up with anybody after AIT.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, once you completed AIT, and was it then that you received the assignment, say that you are going to Vietnam?
Yeah, I was a holdover for a while. They didn't have any orders on me. I think it was because it was such a backlog of people going over there, so they really didn't have my orders. So I was held over there for about a week, and finally got to go home. And I had about a 10-day leave, and then they gave me orders to report to Fort Ord, California, to go to Vietnam.
Okay. All right. And once you finally received the assignment, knew that you were going, of course, I'm sure you probably already knew by that point anyway, but what was your reaction?
You know, I don't really remember, but, I mean, it wasn't anything like, you know, I guess I didn't know what to expect. But, you know, I'd been through basic AIT, so I figured that's, you know, that's where I need to go.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember being scared or anything like that.
Okay. All right. Well, during your short leave there, what'd you do during that time? Did you get a chance to go home?
Yeah, I was at home for about, I guess, for that 10 days, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really remember, you know, what I did during that 10 days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure drank a few beers and whatever.
Right.
Yeah. And just visited with friends and stuff. You know, back then it wasn't like everybody knew what was going on. You know,
right.
It was like, you know, you're going where?
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Well, could you talk a little bit, I guess, about the actual trip over, to Vietnam and what that was like?
Yeah. Well, we got to Fort Ord there. And once we went through a little processing place there, where I guess they were just taking your names and getting your orders and everything. And I think I was like 2 or 3 days late reporting, and they had, I guess, a little clerk there, you know, checking your orders and typing it up. And then if you were late, all they did was, and they had people that were 15 to 30 days late reporting.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did was they typed up, I guess it was like an Article 15 or whatever, to take away money or whatever once you got overseas. And she typed it up and handed it to everybody. And, of course, we would go around the corner and tear it out and throw it in the trash can. And we got on the plane to go over there.
Right.
We stopped in Hawaii first from Fort Ord, and I think we stayed there anywhere from 30 to 45 minutes. I remember they had MPs. They really didn't let us go anywhere other than just deplane and then come back on the plane, as far as I can remember. But I do remember their MP standing there to make sure nobody tried to run, because they had quite a few that would, once I got to Hawaii, they would try to run, you know. So they did have MPs guarding everywhere.
Right. Well, as far as the plane ride over itself, what was the mood like there? Were people talking about it, or was it pretty quiet, or?
You know, I really don't remember.
I
really can't remember what it was like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it was just normal conversation. I'm not real sure.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, time period-wise, when did you arrive in country and where?
Let me see if I can get the dates right. It was right about the first of the year, 1970.
Okay.
So it was probably in like January the 1st or 2nd, somewhere around in there.
All right. Okay.
I can't remember exactly. I'm not real good on these dates.
Sure, that's fine. Doesn't have to be exact. Where did you come in country at?
We came into Tonsonute Air Base and landed there. And they had a big warehouse. That's pretty much all it was. No beds or anything, and you pretty much went into, I think it was, I can't remember the name of it, but it was just, they just stuck everybody in the warehouse until they called your name and told you what unit you were going to, and then they would pick you up from there, and you would go to your unit. So I think we stayed there maybe 2 days.
Okay.
Just sleeping on the floor there.
Right. All right. And what unit were you assigned to at that point?
The first unit I was assigned to was the 199th Light Infantry Brigade.
Okay. All right. And where were they at that time?
See, I'm trying to remember the name. I actually went to a fire base.
Okay.
A fire support base, and it was in, I think it was close to the Nui Baden Mountains.
Okay, so over there around Tay Ninh then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I spent just about my entire time around Tay Ninh province.
All right. Okay. How did you get there from Tonsonute to Tay Ninh, do you remember?
I believe we rode in trucks.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And I know you mentioned that the first a little bit of time there that the unit was out on an operation, I guess, and you were there at the you were there just waiting for them to come back.
Right. They had one guy there, I guess, that met us when we got there, and I remember when we got there, there were three of us, which another guy was with me. His name was Tom Potts, which we were got to be friends. He was from Kentucky.
Okay.
And of course, we came up there, and they said, yep, so y'all are the new guys, and these are the jobs that we have open. I said, we got to have a point man, a machine gunner, and a slack man. And I went, okay, what's a point man and what's a slack man?
Right.
And so he said, oh, you're the point man. I went, oh, okay. And they made Tom Potts a slack man, which is the one that he pretty much runs a compass for the point man.
Okay.
So that was... So I guess that's what we were. And so by the time the unit came out of the field, then I was paired up with the guy that was walking point at that time.
Okay.
And it was I was assigned to a recon unit.
All right.
We worked in 12 men and sometimes 6-man teams doing reconnaissance.
All right. So is this like a LERP unit?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Once you learned that this is what the assignment was going to be, going out in these small teams like that, how did you feel about that?
I really didn't know. I mean, it was kind of you know.
Right.
You don't really know what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I just kind of took, you just kind of take one day at a time, you know, and see what it's like.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it being so damn hot over there and just sweating all the time.
Right.
So it was pretty hot during mm-hmm. that time.
Right. Well, that brings up a question I meant to ask a few minutes ago, which was your, I guess your first impressions of Vietnam.
Well, I remember once we landed there and they opened the doors up and we walked off, I just remember the smell.
Okay.
I mean, it was, I don't know how to describe it. It's just, you know, I remember just a hot blast of air coming in and you could just smell. Distinct.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first thoughts of that place. And I remember we first got there, I guess it was when we were at the point where they were going to assign us to our units.
Mm-hmm.
They came by and picked up some guys for, I guess, for bunker guards to be up in some towers. And they picked me and another guy. Had no idea. First day in Vietnam, and they stuck us on a tower with an M60 machine gun.
Right.
I had no idea what to look for, what anything was, and I think both of us stayed up all night. You know, we were seeing things all night, so
mm-hmm.
that was my first introduction to it, for sure.
Right. Had you had much training on the M60? Did you know much about it?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, we'd had just basic training on it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So that was just the first night, or was it a few days there?
No, it was just that one night.
Okay.
They just went through there picking people to man the towers around the airport there.
Right. Okay. All right. I guess if you could talk a little bit about those first days that you arrived at the firebase there before the unit came back in. If you could talk a little bit about, I guess, what the firebase looked like and what the quarters and the housing was like there.
Well, there actually weren't any housing there.
Okay.
All they had was actually bunkers and stuff.
Okay.
Where we had, it was just a tent. But on the inside of the tents, you had your own, it was just room enough to maybe put a cot in there. And they had like these, you know, the culverts that they use for pipe and stuff.
Okay.
They would have half a culvert stacked and have sandbags stacked on top of it.
Okay.
And sandbags all the way around it inside the tent.
All right.
That's pretty much where we stayed because of incoming, you know, from mm-hmm. rounds coming in. Mortars
right.
and rockets and stuff.
Mm-hmm. All right. What other things did they have? Were you doing at this point besides burning waste?
That's about all I was doing at that time.
Okay.
Just sitting there waiting. I really didn't do anything else.
Right. Okay.
That I can remember.
Mm-hmm. And how long then was it before the unit actually came in?
I believe it was just a couple of days, 2 to 3 days.
Okay.
Most of the time, our missions over there were 5-day missions.
Okay. All right. I guess if you could talk a little bit about your first impressions of the unit and the guys that you were to work with. You don't have to talk about specific names if you don't want to, but if you could talk a little bit about some of the personalities and some of your first impressions of the unit itself.
Well, you know, I remember when they came in, everybody looked so, I mean, you know, dirty. Their boots were ragged, their uniforms were ragged. You know, we were all sitting there just kind of in awe of them when we mm-hmm. saw them coming in. We was going, you know, damn, they looked like they'd been through the ringer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we were just kind of not saying a whole lot, just trying to see what they would say. And the replacement, my guy that I was going to replace, you know, he came over. He was pretty, he was a sharp guy.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been walking point, I think, just about the whole time he had been over there. So I remember he, you know, he was pretty good. I mean, he was trying to explain some stuff to me on what to expect and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
Yeah. So I don't, you know, as a whole, it seemed like a good unit. I mean, a good group of guys and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I think they don't really, you don't really get close to anybody. You know what I mean? When it's a new guy coming in.
Right.
It's like it's a trial period for you.
Okay.
They're going to take you out before they really get close to you or really make friends with you. It's pretty mm-hmm. much a, you know, you got to prove yourself first.
Right. Did it take that, I guess, was, did it take that first combat with the enemy before that, or when would that generally change to where they would accept you?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think that's what kind of gets you in the click, more to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you have your first combat and everything, that kind of, then everybody has something in common.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's when somebody new's coming in, you really don't have anything in common with them.
Right.
And then, you know, he's a new guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you just kind of, you know, keep them to the side until they kind of prove their self.
Right. So it was part of it that they wanted to see if they could depend on you.
Yeah,
under fire.
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
okay.
And it's all a matter of trust. You know, who you can trust.
Right.
And on the LERP units, you really it's actually voluntary. In other words, if you have somebody in that unit that you don't think you can trust, or you know, you just don't really think he'd fit in, you can always you can move them out.
Okay.
You can get them sent to a line unit.
Okay. Was it voluntary on your end as well?
Well, no, I didn't volunteer. I was sent there.
Right.
You know?
Right.
That's what I was asking somebody after a while, you know, and then, but looking around, I think after a while, after I'd been with them, they, you know, I figured I'd rather be out with that many people that I could count on rather than being with a line company, you know,
mm-hmm. right.
30 to 40 people that, you know, you really don't know, you
mm-hmm.
know, so.
All right. Well, given the fact that it was pretty late in the war, by 1970, of course, how was morale?
You know, as far as, you know, when you talk about morale, you know, you're talking about, you know, what do you think about the war? We really didn't, I don't remember that ever even coming up.
Okay.
As far as, is it right or wrong or whatever.
Right.
You're pretty much just, you're doing a job and you want to do the best job you can,
mm-hmm.
you know, regardless of what the job is. And, you know, you want to take care of everybody that you're there with, so.
Right. All right. So then did, I guess from early on you could see that everyone in the team get along pretty well then once you got to know everyone and experienced that first combat?
Yeah, we mm-hmm. did.
Okay.
Got along great.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And that was the only problem was, you know, you had individuals coming in at all different times, you know. It wasn't like you had trained as a unit.
Right.
You were continually having a turnover of people because it was, you know, a one-year tour, and once your tour's up, you were gone.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
A lot of the experience was leaving, and you tried to train up whoever came in there.
Mm-hmm.
The best you could.
Okay.
You know.
All right. Okay. Well, before we get into actually operating, some of the going out into the field, I guess if you could talk just a little bit about what a LERP team was, what you guys did, how many members were there in the team, and what were their jobs, the different types of jobs.
Well, you know, I was with two different units over there.
Okay.
Two different LERP teams. I was with the 1st Cav Division and the 199th.
Okay.
The 199th operated a little bit different than what the 1st Cav did.
Okay.
The 199th, we usually use 12 men to go out.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, I'm not, you know, of course I was a private, so I'm not privy to the information of why they were sending us out on different missions, but some of the missions we would do would be ambushes, just going into different areas and seeing what we could find. Sometimes we would find caches of weapons, food. We would do ambushes, certain trails and stuff. And a lot of times we'd go out and look and as you're walking through the jungle, if you came up on a trail, you would try to identify whether it was what we called a hot trail or a cold trail.
Okay.
In other words, were they using it or were they not, you know, or was it an old one or either an animal trail, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And a lot of times we would set up ambushes on there, look for a good spot for an ambush on there. And a lot of our time was just spent, you know, walking through the jungle looking for different things.
Mm-hmm.
We also did bomb assessments.
In okay.
other words, if they had a B-52 raid or whatever, a lot of times they would send us in there to see what the results of the raid was.
Mm-hmm.
We would find, sometimes we would come up on bunker complexes, and we could either call in airstrikes on it or just different things. One of our missions, I remember one, I'm trying to differentiate between the 199 and the first cab. I'm
sure.
What doing, but,
okay.
A report came back from one of the locals in the area that the VC had taken some of their I guess it was the mountain yards were up there close to where we were.
Okay.
And they had taken some of them as I guess you would say as slaves or whatever, making them work and grow food and stuff like that on a different camp. So,
mm-hmm.
And we went out and tried to find a camp where they were being held hostage, I guess. And we found the camp, came up on the camp, eliminated the VC, and got all the mountain yards that they had imprisoned there, and sent them back. I think at that time they were using those relocation camps. That was one mission.
Okay.
We just do numerous things. I mean, it was just whatever they decided we needed to do. We did a lot of combat assaults, air assaults, and, you know, in the helicopters and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually how we got wherever we were going.
Okay.
We always went into they never prepped the ALZs like they did for the line companies. In other words, the line companies going into a landing zone, they usually prepped it with artillery or whatever.
Right.
But on ours, it was always that we just came in there and, you know, try to do it as quietly as possible and try to just insert us somewhere where they didn't know we were down there.
Mm-hmm.
But does that answer something?
Yeah.
I was trying
oh,
to
yeah.
think a lot. You know, so much, we did so much stuff. And of course, the first when I was working with the 1st Cav Division, it was a little bit different on our operations there.
Okay.
Do you want me to get into that?
If you want, we can wait and talk about the 199th first.
Okay.
Well, let me ask you this question though: how long were you with the 199th before you moved over to the 1st Cav?
Probably about. I think it was right after the Cambodian invasion I went over to the 1st Cav.
Okay, so in May then?
May, I believe.
Okay.
Or somewhere around there.
Okay, all right.
Tell you the truth, and you've probably heard this before if you've interviewed any other ones, I never knew what day it was over
right.
there. A lot of times I didn't even know what month it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I didn't even keep up with anything unless we got back and I go, you know, what month is it? What day is it? You know?
Right.
I guess because every day was the same.
Right. All right. Okay. Talk a little bit more about some of these specific things you said you did, things you talked about, your different assignments, such as a bomb assessment. What would you do during a bomb assessment? How would that work?
What they did on the bomb assessment is we would go into the area and try to go around, you know, where they had bombed and
mm-hmm.
to see. Actually, back then, they were obsessed with body counts, so if how many dead bodies they were out there, what all did they kill, what did it destroy, pretty much that.
Okay.
And I remember they hit one, I guess it was a base camp or something that they had hit on one, and of course, we would call back in on the radio, and, you know, and they would want to know specific information and stuff, and you know, the number of bodies, and I remember we called back one time and said, you know, well, we've got a lot of arms, legs, bodies, you know. I said, you know,
mm-hmm.
how do you want us to do it? Do you want us to count up all the legs and arms and divide by four, or you want us to...
right.
Which was, you know, so that's, you know, we would do that.
Mm-hmm.
On ambushes, we would just stake out a certain place and maybe sit on the trail for a couple of days. I know one time we were, we came up on a trail, I can't remember exactly where we were or anything, but, and of course I was walking point at that time, and I noticed there were a lot of heavy traffic on that trail.
Okay.
And so we actually, you didn't follow the trail, but you would get off the trail and then come back and look at it again. You know, you never walked down the trail, but we kind of paralleled the trail and came back in, and it had gotten a lot wider. And at that time, you know, I saw where it looked like they were, you know, you could tell where there were wheels, where they were pulling something.
Mm-hmm.
And we figured out it was probably one of their machine guns that
okay.
they were pulling down there. And we looked on the map, and it was just a few clicks from one of the major fire bases that was in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to call into them and tell them that, you know, there's a lot of people moving their way. They're probably going to try to, you know, attack the fire base.
Right.
And, of course, sometimes they would take our word for it, sometimes they wouldn't. All we could do was tell them what we thought was going to happen. So,
mm-hmm.
And I guess we trailed on up to probably about a click or, you know, so many clicks close to the base camp and set up, and we were going to set up an ambush on there. But what happened was, I think it was the next day or the next night, they actually hit that firebase and overran it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, when they started firing and everything, the firebase started shooting back. Of course, the bullets were coming over us and everything else, so we pretty much had to hit the dirt. And,
right.
try to get out of the way of our own bullets coming that way, especially 50 caliber bullets and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the NVA and everything were retreating right through us, so we had to pretty much just kind of hunker down on the ground and just kind of wait it all out.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember that.
Right.
I was trying to think of some other things. We acted as a... quick reaction force sometimes.
Okay.
If they needed us anywhere. In other words, we were on standby to go anywhere they needed us. I remember our commanding general was killed over there.
Mm-hmm.
General Bond. I don't know if you've heard of him, but mm-hmm. we had a CAV unit attached to us. I think it was a 17th CAV, you know, with the, they had APCs.
Okay.
They were attacked on a big ambush on the road, and I think General Bond was flying around his helicopter, and they were pretty much had just about wiped him out. And I guess he was going to get out on the ground and take command or whatever, but I think he stepped out of his helicopter and they shot and killed him.
Mm-hmm.
And we were on a firebase not too far from there, and of course they activated us as a QRF, and we had to go in there and try to mop up after that. But most of them had already gone by that time.
Right. All right.
I can't think of anything else.
Okay. All right.
Offhand. You know, it comes and goes to me.
Sure, sure. All right. Well, I know you talked about, well, first of all, with your assignment right away being put as a point man, and you, how long did it take you to learn, to figure out, and I guess to feel as comfortable as you could feel about knowing what you were doing?
Well, it took quite a few months, really, to really feel comfortable. I think the guy I replaced, I think he stayed for about another month, I guess.
Okay.
And kinda, what he did is he just kind of shadowed me as my, right behind me. It was a learning experience, to say the least, but
mm-hmm.
you had to know what to look for. In other words, if you were going through the jungle, you didn't want to walk into a bunker complex. So you kind of there's a lot of pressure on you there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and I made a few mistakes, hoping, you know, I'm just glad it didn't get anybody hurt. But, you know, I had walked up on Buckers before and never even saw him.
Mm-hmm.
And he would point them out to me, you know. And then he kind of showed me what to look for as far as when you came up, if you were coming up on a suspected bunker complex, was look for smaller trees that were cut down anywhere around there. That's usually what they built them out of.
Okay.
Just different things. And I remember, I think it was my, probably the first or second time I was walking point by myself up there. And I ran smack into an NVA column.
Mm-hmm.
And probably within 20 feet of each other.
Oh, wow.
Him looking up, me looking up, and I just blasted away, and he blasted away. And that was a eye-opener there,
mm-hmm.
for sure.
Right. So that was your first encounter with the enemy?
That was my first encounter,
mm-hmm.
yep.
All right.
Head-to-head. I mean, it was. I hadn't been in country very long at all.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys end up taking any casualties as a result of that, or how did you
turn? No, we
okay.
didn't.
Mm-hmm.
We got, I think I got one or two of them, and we didn't suffer any.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I was I was ahead of the, you know, of the unit there,
mm-hmm.
so I was probably 10, 15 yards ahead.
Okay.
So.
All right.
Most of the bullets were just going over my head, cracking around me.
Right.
And they turned around and they, you know, they hauled butt, so.
Mm-hmm.
And then we found a bunker complex not too far from there.
Okay.
There was actually blood trails leading to that, so.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, about how many were there?
Of them?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Okay.
I just saw the ones in front of me and I let go.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't.
How many did you see then?
Well, there were three that I saw.
Okay.
That were in a trail. I mean, in the jungle, you can't see, you know. I mean, it's pretty,
mm-hmm.
it was pretty thick where it was. And
okay.
that's the reason, I guess, that we got so close.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't making any noise, and neither were we going through the bushes, but we just happened upon it. That's, most of the time when we would have contact, it was like that. It was very close.
Mm-hmm.
Because we didn't make any noise, usually not much noise anyway, going through the jungle.
Right.
Not like the line companies that, you know, you could hear them half a mile away. But us, usually, for our safeguard, we were pretty silent going through the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
So, and most of our contacts were up close and personal.
Okay. All right. Well, you talked about the way they would disguise their bunkers, cutting down the small trees and things. Could you talk, I guess, a little bit more about how they would use the environment to their advantage, I guess, how they would camouflage things and how that all that worked?
Yeah, well, most time on their bunkers, you know, they would be covered with ground cover, and on their bunkers it would just be maybe 2 feet by 1 foot opening, you know, and they would place like bunkers around different places like that.
Mm-hmm.
They were pretty well camouflaged. You really had to be sharp to pick them up, you know.
Okay.
And that's what happened a lot of times. You would walk right into the middle of one before you even knew it was there.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, from your perspective, I guess, if you could talk a little bit about your impressions of the enemy and how would you evaluate their, I guess, their fighting ability?
Well, I mean, you know, they've been fighting a long time.
Mm-hmm.
They were very adept at jungle warfare. And after a while, I think, you know, after we had been in the jungle for a period of time, maybe 6, 7, 8 months, we were probably on their equal as far as that.
Okay.
You know, I mean, you know, it's one of those things where you really have to get in there and live like them and operate like them.
Mm-hmm.
And you start almost getting like them, in other words.
Right. All right.
But they were, You know, there were different ones. You had the VC, and then you had the NVA. They were just, I guess they operated slightly different.
Okay.
You know, as far as their tactics and stuff. The VC were probably more at a, they were mostly a hit and run. A lot of the NVA would stand and fight, but most of the VC were hit and run tactics.
Okay.
So.
All right. Which were you more likely to run into at this point early on? Would it be VC or NVA, or did it just depend?
It really depended on which area you were in, but okay. There were quite a few NVA that we were in the area where we operated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could tell by their uniforms and stuff. I remember one of them that we had killed in an ambush, and he was actually, you got where you could pretty much tell them apart by looking at them.
Okay.
You know, not profiling or anything, but you can pretty much tell where what they were, where they were from, or from what area. In other words, you know, the Vietnamese, the VC, were very small. Some of the ones that came from the NVA, if they came from either the Chinese border or if they were from way up north, were a lot taller. They were more of a Chinese build.
Okay.
Some of them were almost as big as an American.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
All right. Well, speaking of differences in the size and everything, and coming from the Chinese border, did you ever come across any enemy with other nationalities, Khmer or Chinese or anything like that?
And actually the Cambodians looked a little different. They were a little darker, more of a, I don't know, their facial features were a little bit different.
Okay.
Plus the some of the ones either they were either Chinese or either they were from close to the border with China from North Vietnam, but you know their facial features are a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
The Mountain Yards more of a Indian looking, I guess. They look even different. Of course, I mean they were fighting against us, but there was also I know we had two or three different times we had reports of a Caucasian fighting with the NVA, that somebody had spotted him, and they would send a team of us out to try to find him.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And we got one glimpse of him one time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And we actually took a shot at him, but it was too far away. Mm-hmm. It was just a,
What did you guys think, what nationality, I guess, what did you think, it was a Russian advisor, or?
I think that was the thing, you know, like I say, I was a Spec 4 or private, and I had no idea of the intel reports, you know. We would give them an intel dump when we got back, but we never knew what was going on in the minds of those above us, but
mm-hmm.
I think that's probably what they thought. They were really after him. I mean, there was numerous times they would get us up, and you know, we get a report, and they give us a grid square. We go in there, and we go look for him.
Right.
So, but I think the one time we saw him, we were on the side of side of a mountain, looking over a valley over there. And I don't know how far he was, but we did pick him up walking with a bunch of them.
Okay,
that's the only time we ever saw him.
All right. Let's see. You mentioned coming into contact with the Cambodians. Did you guys ever go across the fence?
Quite a bit.
Okay. All right.
You putting that in?
If it's okay for you to talk about.
Yeah. How many years has it been? 70, 80, 90. Yeah. Well, yeah, there were quite a few excursions into Cambodia. And we did it quite often, just for different things, just for intel reports. There were major trails leading out of Cambodia into Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've done, you probably know, if you've looked at Vietnam, it was a lot of major infiltration routes coming in from there. And a lot of times that's what we would monitor, trying to see what was coming in.
Right.
I mean, we also did, you know, we would also do the recon. In other words, setting up, watching and see how many came by or whatever.
All right. So then monitoring movement down the trail?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Did you guys ever come into any contact while you were over there on that side?
You know, a lot of times we never knew which side we were on.
Okay.
You know, but yeah, I'm sure we did.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the stuff over there was either reconning an area or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times we would recon an area. I guess it was for later on if they did a B-52 strike on or something.
Okay.
But it just took so long for them to get, I guess, clearance for a B-52 strike.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, if I could back up just a moment, you talked about setting up ambushes quite a bit. Could you talk, I guess, a little bit about the tactics involved with an ambush? Would they always be night ambushes, or how would that work?
No, it could be day or night.
Okay.
It's depending. Once you set up on a hot trail, you just waited. In other words, you send out your claymores. Everybody, our basic load was a little bit different than what the line units took. The line units usually, they packed everything in their rucksack for usually 3 days, and they would get resupplied after 3 days. We didn't usually get resupplied in the jungle because that would give away our position, so our normal mission was 5 days, so we actually had to carry 5 days, 5 to 6 days with us. So our rucksack weighed probably half again as much as what one of the line units would weigh.
Okay.
So we had to take 5 days worth of food, 5 days worth of water if it was a dry season. I think my basic load was I carried 21 magazines plus one in my weapon. If we took a 60 machine gun with us, every man usually had around 100 rounds with him. And also you carried claymores. Just depended how many claymores you took. I think I usually carried 2 claymores.
Okay.
And we also carried 2 radios at least, sometimes 3. And I always had one was always on either our support frequency, which could be, or depending on where we were, artillery, air, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was usually for whoever was keeping up with us, our base unit.
Okay.
And as far as the claymores, that's what we would do as far as setting that up. If you had more than one, then you would, of course, have some dead cord to daisy chain them together.
Mm-hmm.
And we would just set them up on certain places in the trail, camouflage them, and then back off and hide and wait for something to come down the trail, pretty much.
Right. All right. How often, I guess, if you could venture a guess, how often during these ambushes would they actually be successful? Would the enemy actually come through the ambush position?
That's a good question. I don't really know. I mean, we set up quite a few, and some were successful. I'd say maybe 20% of the time we would have a successful ambush.
Mm-hmm. All right.
That was just one of the things that we did. You know, we didn't always set up an ambush. Sometimes we would just, of course, every night when you set up a camp wherever you were going to stay for the night, you also set your you set your claymores out with a trip flare also.
All right.
And we have had them walk through a trip flare before.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would blow a claymore on them.
Mm-hmm. All right. How would a night position work as far as people being awake and sleeping and all that? How did that work?
Well, what we did is usually we slept in a type of a circle, so that of course, from from dark to daylight, there was always somebody up, and we would just pass it from man to man,
mm-hmm.
To whoever was on. And usually we had Claymore set up in a perimeter, and we had all the clackers set so that you could hit any clacker at any one time, you know, whoever was on call.
Mm-hmm.
Or not on call, but on guard.
Right. All right. So it would usually just be one person at a time?
Yeah, just left one person up.
Okay.
Unless the situation dictated different, you know.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. In the times when, I guess since you were a recon unit, in most cases were you supposed to just observe and not make contact, or did that just matter? Did that just depend on the mission?
Well, you would think so, but I tell you, we pretty much made contact and did anything else. I mean,
okay.
We did it all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right.
It just depended. I mean, as far as us, I remember, I mean, if we had 12 men, we would take on an equal number of enemy.
Okay.
I mean, at least.
Right.
Even when we're working as 5 men, we've taken on as many as 20 before.
Okay.
So.
Mm-hmm. Were there times then whenever you guys would see a larger unit and you were just to sit there and observe and not to make contact?
Yeah. In fact, it was the one time when they sent us out after that Caucasian guy, and we took a pot shot at him.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved from there and set up, and I guess they sent out a lot of people looking for us.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty scary there. We had we pretty much had to crawl on our bellies for about 100 yards and hide and everything until they passed. But they probably sent out a whole company looking for us.
Oh, wow.
I guess they figured it was a small unit.
Right.
And there was pretty good bounty, I think, on us.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we've done that before. I mean, they've come as close as I could probably reach out and touch one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So.
Wow. Right. So in cases like that, would you guys just lay still in the grass?
Yeah.
As camouflaged as you could be, I guess.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Sure do. I mean, just try to get down as much as you can, and hopefully they won't see you.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would, like I say, they would send people after us a lot of times. I don't know if they were sappers or whoever, but if they ever figured out you were a small unit, they would really try to send somebody after you.
Mm-hmm. Right. Did that happen very often where, I guess like you said, they could almost reach out and touch them?
That's quite a few times. I mean,
okay.
if we were just doing a recon and we knew there was a large number of them, we wouldn't really break an ambush or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But there's quite a few times we would sit there and watch them walk down the trail.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Just to give a report back, and you know, a lot of times they would drop artillery in on them because they wouldn't know where it was coming from.
Right.
Or if we were looking at them. So
mm-hmm.
We had snipers attack. Well, this first cat, you know, I get the two. You know, so I moved over to the first cav division. We had snipers attached to us.
Okay.
So we had four snipers attached to us, and usually we took one out per team.
Okay. All right. Well, like I said, well, if you don't mind, I'll ask you about that in just a few more minutes when we get to whenever you made the transition to the first cav.
Okay.
This early time here with the 199th, did you guys ever come across any booby traps or anything like that?
We did come across some, but mm-hmm. they weren't as bad there in the areas where we were. Usually
mm-hmm.
they were on a map or something, or they knew where, you know, they had gotten a lot of booby traps before. But they weren't as bad where we were.
Okay.
And I think plus working as a small unit, we didn't go where normal units went, in other words.
Okay.
You know, on the booby traps, they usually put them out for somebody to, in other words, buy a village or on main routes that they knew a soldier might take. You know what I mean? We were mostly in the jungle. We were probably in areas that you know, a human hadn't even been before.
Okay.
In the middle of the jungle. So we weren't, we never had problems with booby traps as far as where we were.
Okay. All right. Well, being out in the jungle then, away from the population, did you guys ever come into contact with the local civilian population?
Very rarely.
Okay.
Mostly where we operated was in the free fire zone.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So we didn't really have to worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, other than sometimes if we were getting inserted in a different way, they had inserted the teams before by. One time it was like a convoy going out, APCs and stuff, and we got on the convoy and they stopped to like take a break. And at that time, it was at a point where they wanted to insert us into a certain area, and we would go from there and walk into the jungle.
Okay.
And sometimes, I mean, we've been around some of the populace, but not very many.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I guess being out in the jungle, did you guys come across much as far as wildlife and insects and things like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, we were snakes, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We have set up a perimeter before, and we've had either tigers or something, big cats.
Mm.
Walk up to it, you could hear them at night.
Oh, wow.
Elephants, I think we saw a few elephants while we were out there, which there weren't that many there, I guess, because of the war, but we have seen them. Sometimes when we're working down toward the rivers and lowlands, you know, you can see the big anacondas.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh.
Yeah, we saw probably, oh, God, I don't know how big this one was. We were actually going toward the river. We had to cross the river, and we were going down close to it, and I was walking point, and I walked over what I thought was a log, and it got back to about the fifth man back, and he went, "Hey, man, this log's moving." I didn't know what he was talking about, and he just took the butt of his M16, and he hit it, you know, and the damn snake's head rose up about 20 feet over there on the other side of it.
Oh, man. Wow.
I guess it was a big anaconda.
Right.
I don't know. Uh-huh. It's time to get out of there.
Was anyone ever injured or hurt from snakes or any of the wildlife at all? Any?
I don't remember of anybody.
Okay.
Not in our unit. They never was.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Which is kind of, you know, you wonder why. But, and really, while I was out there, I really wasn't looking for. Of course, that was the least of your worries, was a snake or something, you know.
Sure.
But I never remember anybody getting bit or anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I guess getting back to the population for a moment. I know you said that you guys had some contact with the Montagnards. What were your impressions of them? What did you think about them and their and I guess could you tell about their loyalties and where they lie?
Well, of course, we couldn't speak to them because we didn't have anybody that could speak that. Even the Vietnamese interpreters couldn't speak to them either because they spoke a different language.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, they were pretty primitive.
Okay.
I mean, one of the villages that we came into was, they were actually using crossbows, homemade crossbows.
Okay.
Of course, the women didn't have anything up top.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
And the men pretty much wore, like, the loincloths and stuff. I mean, they were pretty much like an American Indian, I guess, would be back in that time.
Right.
But they were pretty much just existed off the land. You know, but I don't have any. I think at that time probably the South Vietnamese were too, but I think they were being exploited. You know.
Okay.
I don't think they were hardly. I don't guess they were as far as education. I don't think they had any education, but I think they just pretty much lived up in the mountains and everywhere else, kind of on their own.
Okay. How about in South Vietnamese troops, Arvin troops. Did you guys ever do any work at all with them or ever have any contact with them?
We did. At one of our missions one time was to, there was a South Vietnamese Arvin Ranger unit that they wanted us to take out, and I guess they told us to take them out and get them bloody, is pretty much what they said. In other words, get them into contact. I think we had, first night we were out, we had about three or four of them go AWOL. I guess they went home. I think some of them were okay. Some of their special operations troop were okay, but I didn't think a whole lot about the South Vietnamese Army in general. I think they were there to let the U.S. do the fighting, and they wanted to sit on their fire bases. They didn't. They really didn't go out and patrol and do stuff like we were. And there was a lot of animosity between the U.S. troops, the actual troops that were out there doing the fighting, and the South Vietnamese troops. They didn't get along real well.
Well, one other question I had to ask you about, let's see, this... I know you talked about being out in the field. You would generally go out 5 days at a time, right? When you would come back in, how long would you be in before you'd go out in the field again?
Of course, it it varied according to missions that they had for us. Usually, we weren't in for maybe a couple of days. And then we were going back out. We'd come back in long enough to maybe take a shower if we could, depending on where we were, and get resupplied, and then go back out. A lot of times it was just come back in, get resupplied, and go right straight back out.
When you did have a little bit of time, a couple of days or so, how would you spend your free time? What would you guys do?
Just trying to get something to eat, trying to get a shower or something, but, you know, it's pretty much just kind of laying around.
Was sleep a big thing at that point?
Yeah, it was. But, I mean, you know, it depended on mission. Sometimes they would send us out to a certain area. We would leave that area, go to another area, maybe come back in to somewhere that we really didn't have a set base. I mean, we had a base that where some of our stuff was, but most everything that we owned, everything you carried in your rucksack, because you never knew when you were going to come back to that area. So I remember, I think there was, I can't remember what the operation was, but we were gone for 78 days before we actually came back to our base, and it was pretty much 78 days without a shower or anything other than just getting resupplied with food. The only way we bathed was if it was a river or something, we would try to wash off in the river. Our uniforms would just pretty much just rot off of us. Because of the humidity and everything. And, you know, prickly heat. I guess you've heard of prickly heat.
No, I haven't.
They call it prickly heat. I guess it's like little bumps that come up all over you, I guess, from getting nasty and sweaty and dirty clothes. You would have that all over you, plus the leeches, if they were all over you, you'd have leech bites on it. Get infected, so it was a mess.
During this time when you would come in to the fire base, whenever you did get the chance to come in, would you do things like write letters home at that point?
Usually that's what you did, at least if the mail if the mail had caught up to you by then, and you get your mail. And they also had what they call an SP package or something. It was like, had candy, cigarettes, and stuff like that in it. And they usually had some of those for us. And just try to get, you know, new uniforms or whatever you could get, you know, next mission out. Just try to refit before you went back out.
Well, as far as the food and things were concerned, was it pretty much always sea rations?
Yeah, well, we had they had hot meals on the fire bases if we could ever get one, which we might get one once every 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
get a hot meal. But it was mostly C rations. We also had what they call alert rations.
Okay.
It's like a freeze dried. Comes in a little package. You put hot water in it and just kind of seal it.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty good. I mean, they're real good rations. But the only problem was it depended on the season over there. If it's a dry season, you didn't carry a bunch of alert rations because you didn't have that much water to spare.
Right.
So usually we carried more C rations in the dry season. In the wet season, it wasn't a problem. We carried a lot of alerts. Mm-hmm. Plus, they were lighter.
Right.
It came in a package kind of like what the MREs do today.
Okay.
And it was a gray package at chicken stew, beef stew. I could probably name every one of them.
All right.
Yeah. But as far as the sea rations, you didn't carry the whole box of sea rations. You broke them down into what you thought you would need.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the weight, I usually just carried enough, like some fruit or something like that, and hot chocolate, coffee, stuff like that, and try to get it down to, so all you had was like one meal a day in the
mm-hmm.
evening.
Okay.
And just some fruit or something during the day.
Mm-hmm.
So needless to say, you weren't going to get fat over there.
Right. Was that difficult to only be able to eat one time a day, or is that something you get used to?
No, you get used to it.
Uh-huh.
And then, you do it because of the weight, because by the time we got
right.
all of our rucksacks packed with everything we had to carry, I don't know how much they weighed on that first day when you went out,
mm-hmm.
but it was heavy.
Okay.
You know, you couldn't really get off the ground. You'd have to grab a tree and kind of work your way up. It was so heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And, humping that thing got to be a... it was pretty hard there when it first, and usually after that first night out, or first evening out, you try to eat some stuff, and it got lighter as the days went on.
Mm-hmm. Right. On those the days that you would stay out, well, on the times that you would stay out more than 5 days, would you be resupplied by helicopter, or how would that work?
Yeah, we could be,
okay.
Or if we were close to a fire base, we could actually go into the fire base and get resupplied.
Okay.
It was one or other.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. And I know you talked about water being an issue, particularly during the dry season. But
right.
what would your water sources be during the wet season and the dry season?
Well, in the wet season, it was whatever you caught when it was raining.
Okay.
Or you stop by a stream or whatever and fill up.
Mm-hmm.
Same way in the dry season, except there's just not as much water available.
Okay.
You're either going to have to go down if you're in the high ground, you got to go down low to try to get some water,
mm-hmm.
or try to find it. Of course, they had those little iodine tablets.
Okay.
That you put in there.
Right.
And I used to carry it. I carried when I left to go out on a mission. I had a 5-quart canteen, I think, and a 2-quart and a 1-quart.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So that was what you took, but you tried to ration the water that you drank,
mm-hmm.
especially in the dry season.
Right. All right. Okay. Well, we've talked about some of the things in more general terms, but are there, I guess getting back to operating out in the field, particularly during these first few months with the 199th, are there any particularly memorable moments or firefights that stick out in your mind that you could possibly talk about, operations, anything like that happened?
Well, of course, I've already told you about the one where I came face-to-face with a guy there in
right.
that one. But I was trying to think of some of the others. Some of the others, they go pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it might seem like a while when you're in a firefight, but they actually go pretty quick. Most of them were just hit and runs.
Okay.
Not a whole lot. I was trying to think. I guess the only other one would have been, I think it was one time we were out, and I actually, when I was walking point, and I actually ended up in the middle of a NVA base camp. I came through the backside, I guess, and I didn't see any of the signs that it was a base camp, and I came through, and there were a couple of them sitting there, and I opened up on them, and they shot an RPG, and some of it caught me through the foot and arm and everything, and so I was sitting there, and I was kind of in between my unit behind me that was firing and them firing over me.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't think of too much more. This is just with the 199th, right?
Right, right. I guess that time that you took the shrapnel from the RPG, was it serious enough to be medevaced or
no? Yeah, they medevaced me.
Okay.
I came back to the 93rd of back, and I think it's Benoit.
Okay.
They sewed me up, and I stayed in the rear for a few days, and then came back to the field.
Mm-hmm. All right. And overall, how would you say the medical treatment you received, how would you rate it?
Oh, they were excellent doctors and everything over there.
Okay.
Very good. I guess I left and I had the stitches in my foot, and I came back to our, I guess it was the 199th headquarters there, and that was in Long Bend, I believe.
Okay.
And of course I'm supposed to stay out for, I think he said, 2 weeks till it all healed and stuff, or the doctor did, but I ended up, I think the next couple of days they needed somebody to do convoy security, so they stuck me wrapped up foot and all on a Jeep, and I had to pull security for convoys.
Right.
For a couple of days. Came back and they sent me to the field, and I think on the next mission that we came in contact, my foot busted open again. I guess from getting wet and everything, so it busted open. So actually I had to be medevaced again back to the same doctor, and he sewed it up, and of course he was raising hell.
Right.
While I was already out in the field, I said, well, because they told me to, you know.
Right.
So he wasn't real pleased, and I think he called up the commander. So I actually stayed out a little bit longer that time before I went back.
Okay.
But I was ready to get back in the field. I didn't like being in the rear anyway.
Mm-hmm. Did you go back to your regular team?
Yeah.
Okay.
I just went back to regular one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did they have a replacement for you while you were out, or did they just operate without you?
No, they. I guess some guy took over.
Okay.
You know, I had all along. We kind of trained together, Tom Potts, the guy that was walking behind me, so he just took over as as point man.
Mm-hmm.
But I walked point the whole time I was over there.
Mm-hmm. All right. And I know you said you couldn't remember specific dates or anything like that, but how long do you think, how long into your tour was this when you got wounded?
You know, I have no idea. I don't know what month it was. I was thinking it was in, it was toward the end. End of when I was with the 199th,
okay.
So.
All right. And how often do you think when you guys would go out in the field for one of these 5-day tours out in the field or longer, how often would you actually come into contact with the enemy or at least see the enemy?
We were probably different than some of the line units. We saw them a lot more than most of the line units did. You know, I've talked to people before that they might not have even seen any enemy
mm-hmm.
while they were over there for the whole tour, you know, but we saw them quite a bit.
Okay.
But as far as, you know, there was a lot of downtime where you wouldn't do anything. You wouldn't see anybody or anything. You kind of got complacent, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then other times you would see them every day. So it just really depended.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you never knew.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think that was one of the bad things was you know, I guess complacency. And you haven't seen anything in a long time. Everybody gets kind of lax, and then all of a sudden something happens, you know.
Right.
So.
All right.
But I don't really know how many times
Right. Okay. All right. Well, before moving on to the first calf, during this time with the 199th, if you don't mind me asking this question, did you guys take any casualties during that time?
Yeah, we did.
Okay.
We had one guy killed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we did.
Mm-hmm. All right. And how about, I know you talked about just people coming in and out as their DROs came up, as their year came to a close. How much overturn was there during that period? But I guess by the time that you got there, by the time that you left with the 199th to go to the first calf, how many of the original guys that you were working with were still there?
Still with the 199th?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
You know, I don't really know.
Okay.
There was like three of us that came, you know, around the same time. So, of course, you know, ours was, we were going back at the same time. We just had people coming in all the time, just different times, you know.
Right.
Gosh, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only one that, of course, I kept up with was Tom Potts, because we left the 199th and both of us went over to the first cab to the same unit.
Okay.
Which was unusual.
Right.
We were glad. But.
Right. So by the time you left the LERP unit with the 199th, did the team look pretty different then from when you started?
It looked different, but I think we're pretty much. I mean. It was a pretty good. I mean, it was a good team. I mean, it wasn't. I mean, you know what I mean. I mean,
right.
We had a very good officer over there at one time, first lieutenant. We went through about three or four lieutenants over there.
Okay.
Not necessarily killed, but shot. But
right.
The one that we had that really stood out was his name was O.B. Adams.
Okay.
Lieutenant Adams, and he was a jam up. He was. Very good officer, and I think we had another lieutenant that came in. He lasted about a month. He got shot through the neck.
Mm-hmm.
Had another one come through. I think he was shot him in the leg. A lot of times they would try to, if they came up, you know, they would try to take out, of course, the officer. They would usually look for wherever the radio was, and they would take out whoever was talking on the radio or close to the radio.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we had another lieutenant, I guess it was shot through the leg.
Okay.
I think one of the, which I just thought about that when I was thinking about him getting shot through the leg, but we had come up on a bunker complex, and we were actually searching the bunker complex, and went in one of the bunkers, and it was a full medical hospital setup.
Okay.
They, you know, had medicines and everything up there. You can see where they had taken them in there. I think that was not too long before we'd had an ambush, and there was still bloody rags on the table. And we left there and went and set up. I guess had left the bunker complex and set up for the night, and that was when I guess they had some of them trailing us, and they opened up on us. Late that evening, it was almost dark, and that was when they got our one lieutenant, shot him through the leg.
Mm-hmm.
He survived, but it was pretty bad. Because if that happens at night, then you've got to try to, you know, what do? Do you stay there, or do you try to move, or you know? So
right,
we did go in some of the bunker complexes.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, go in there and search them.
Right. All right. Well, you mentioned if someone was wounded at night, that brought up a question I meant to ask you earlier.
Right.
As far as setting up your night positions, would you generally set up somewhere and then move for security purposes, or how did that work, or would you stay where you set up?
Well, in that particular instance, we moved about maybe 50 meters to a different place. It was a little more secure, and
okay.
we just tightened up the perimeter. We really couldn't move anywhere because of where we were. We couldn't move. I mean, we didn't travel at night.
Okay.
I think they were the only ones that traveled at night most of the time. But,
okay.
Yeah, we just pretty much had to hunker down there. And that's the only problem, too, is trying to get a medevac in, you know, when it gets dark or, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we couldn't get a medevac in. Might not be able to get somebody out to the next day.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a problem.
Right. All right. Were there, I guess what I'm wanting to ask here is, could you talk about, I guess, the relationship between the guys on the ground and the helicopter crews? I mean, I know you guys relied on them for medevac and for resupply, but how did all that work? Was there a relationship as far as appreciation and things like that between you guys? I've heard some veterans talk about that, so if you could comment on that.
Yeah. Well, we didn't have a whole lot of interaction with them.
Okay.
Them picking us up, dropping us off, inserting us somewhere, but the medevac units were excellent over there. They had some of the best. I mean, they'd fly if there's any way possible.
Mm-hmm.
They would come in there and get somebody out, regardless.
Okay.
So, I mean, as far as that, we didn't have a whole lot of contact with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, other than the gunships and stuff like that, I talked to them on the radio before. You know.
Right.
Really, I mean, most of the time, as far as going out on a mission, we never saw the air crews. I mean, we'd talk to them once we got there, and they would just pick us up and insert us somewhere. So we didn't have a whole lot of one-on-one talking with them or anything.
Right, right.
Yeah.
All right. And you talked about the lieutenants and some of them being wounded. Would it always be a lieutenant as the team leader out in the field with you guys, or how did that work?
Well, actually, if we had a lieutenant with us, sometimes then it got to a point where we didn't have any more. I guess they didn't have any more lieutenants to send with us.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just whoever had the most experience.
Okay.
I mean, the thing was, you know, we'd had lieutenants come out there before, and we pretty much just used them to monitor the radio and call in stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they had just gotten there, they were not going to, you know, they might tell us where we were supposed to go and
okay.
if it needed to be done, but, you know, we relied on people that had been there a long time, the ones with the experience.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that we were, I guess, not disrespectful, but, you know, a lot of times it's not rank that's in charge in the jungle. It's the one with the most experience.
Right, right.
So,
okay.
And most of them understood that.
Mm-hmm. All right. In most cases, with the one with the most experience, would it usually be an NCO, or would you have privates there that had more experience at times?
Well, of course, it's just about going to be either an NCO or a Spec 4 because
okay.
they've been there the longest.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. it could be an E5.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And, okay. Next question. You talked about the bunker complexes and come across the hospitals. Could you talk a little bit more about that and what they were like? And also, were there tunnel complexes as well? I know, like down at Coochie in particular, were the famous tunnels. But
right.
did you guys come across them as well?
You know, we never went in them.
Okay.
We'd mark them on a map or something, and I'm sure some of the land companies might have come in later and went in them.
Mm-hmm.
This particular one was just happened to be, we just happened to go into this one, and it was a hospital. It was connected somewhat to some tunnels, but I'm not sure where they went. We didn't go. I wasn't going to crawl in the tunnel and try to find out where it went, but.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was the only place. And the only reason we went to that was you know, like I say, we had seen some blood trails out there from the ambush, and it led into there. So we actually went in there to see what was there,
mm-hmm.
and that's when we found that.
Mm-hmm. All right.
We really didn't. I mean, we didn't have any, what you say, tunnel rats. Most of them were with the the line companies. You know, that was something for them to do. That wouldn't, you know, if they were going to go in there and blow up a tunnel complex or whatever, that was up to them with some engineers or something. That wasn't our job.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. Well, I guess, is there anything else we should say about this first, your time with the 199th, any other memorable moments or anything like that before moving on to the first calf?
I can't think of any right now. I'm sure I will later on. But,
all right.
I was trying to think. That was some of them kind of get mixed up, and I can't remember which is which.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But that's all I can think of.
Okay.
As far as with the first cab, we worked in 5-man teams rather than 12.
Okay.
Pretty much the same type missions with a few other missions added in.
Mm-hmm.
We actually did prisoner snatches.
Okay.
In other words, we would sit on the hot trail and wait for somebody to come through there. They tell us they needed a prisoner, so we would go out there in a certain area and go snatch one up for them.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the other things we did what they call a stay behind ambush.
Okay.
Which was when the first cab was notorious for coming into a place, establishing a fire base, and staying there for 2 weeks, and then they would grab everything and go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because of the air mobile concept, they
right.
can move around fairly quick. And and I guess the S2 or the intel section found out that when they would leave a place like that, that a lot of the NVA and VC would come in there and scavenge for stuff. In other words, you know, being GIs, they would leave stuff laying around and which stuff that they could use.
Mm-hmm.
So they came up with a bright idea of sticking a team of us on one section of the fire base, get in a bunker, double sandbag, make sure and make sure the only avenue of approach would be to our front where we could see, and they would wait till a bunch of them came up there and started scavenging stuff, and then we'd call in artillery and gunfire on them.
Mm-hmm.
We did mechanical ambushes, which is a little different than a regular ambush. It's they call it mechanical ambush instead of calling it a booby trap, because that was against the Geneva Convention.
Okay.
So what that was a it's pretty much just like a you would hook claymores and daisy chain them together.
Mm-hmm.
Run a trip wire across the trail, and usually powered by one of your used Prick 25 batteries.
Okay.
And use a C-ration spoon and a clothespin, and put two tacks on it, and that's your contact. And when they trip it, spoon comes out, tacks hit, and all the claymores go off.
Mm-hmm.
And we could usually set that, and then we could get it, you know, get 100 meters or so away, so we didn't have to be right there by it.
Right, right.
And we used that. They sent us out, sent five of us out with a, I'm not really sure what they were. They were, it was a group of, they weren't South Vietnamese, they were pretty much mercenaries, I guess.
Okay.
But they sent five of us out, and what we were supposed to do is we were the radio communications back, and we traveled with them while they went through and did different missions. They would run through a village and pretty much kill everything that was there.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just there pretty much as observers.
Right.
So, I think what else? We did sniper missions.
Right. Okay.
We had one sniper per team. We had four teams. Usually three teams were out, one team was back. We did our own radio communications with the base, so we carried two radios per team. One team would do all the radio communications all night with the other teams that were out. That's all I can think of right now.
Okay. All right. Well, one question I have for you is, actually, how did the transfer from the 199th to the first calf take place, and what prompted it?
Well, they actually, the 199th was going home. They
okay.
followed the colors and went home.
Okay.
And we went, I think, right a little bit before that or right during that time.
Mm-hmm.
Sometime around that time, they transferred us over to alert team in the first calf.
Okay. All right. So did your whole team went together then?
No.
Just that's right. I remember you said just you and.
Yeah, that was just the two of us. Me and Tom Potts were the only ones. That
mm-hmm.
We actually went to the same team.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, I know you said it happened right around the time of the Cambodian incursion.
Right.
Did you guys actually participate in that? Did you go into Cambodia with that?
No, not with the first cab, no.
Okay. Okay.
That was during the time when, I think it was General Casey's. We'd been there just a little while, I guess, when General Casey's father was killed, I think, in a helicopter crash.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was in July, though.
Okay.
Everybody was coming back out.
Mm-hmm. All right. Asking similar questions to what I asked you earlier about the team with the 199th. Again, you don't have to get into specific personalities, but could you talk a little bit about this new team with the first calf?
Well, we didn't have any. We had no officers with us.
Okay.
It was all in the five men. Usually the highest rank was an E5.
Okay.
And like I say, we had four teams. And we pretty much just operated on our own. They had us kind of, even on the fire base, they had us pretty much separated from everybody else. I think they had barbed wire between us and everybody else there. They kind of
mm-hmm.
thought we were a little strange.
Right.
So they kept us kind of away to ourselves over there.
Mm-hmm.
But we had some characters, to say the least.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, you talked about... You just mentioned being separated from the line companies in that way. But did you guys have some contact with them? And was there any sort of rivalry, anything like that?
Well, we hardly ever, we never, the only time we ever saw them, we could hear them coming through the jungle, or
mm-hmm.
they actually almost ran into one of our ambushes one time because they had a lieutenant had read the map wrong,
mm-hmm.
and that was almost a disaster.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we had to hide because we knew if we popped up, they were going to shoot anything they saw. So we had to hide till they almost came right up on us, and then we just reached up and grabbed them by the arm, scared the crap out of them. Said, you know, hey,
right,
you know, we're here. What are you doing here?
Mm-hmm.
And so finally, we had to get the little lieutenant there and say, hey, sir.
Right.
Respect. You screwed up. You almost got your people killed.
Mm-hmm. Right. Did you get any sense of feeling that, I guess, I don't know how to phrase it, but did they look at you guys as kind of elite compared to them, to themselves? Or did you kind of get any feelings about that? Or did you see anything like that?
Well, most of them say, you know, they thought we was crazy. You know, other than that, I don't know about being mm-hmm. elite. They thought we were a little different, which I guess we were.
Right.
But,
right.
Yeah, I know. Speaking back to the operations, I remembered one thing we did one time. We were on top of a mountain, and I don't know where, but we were a radio relay for an artillery for a big operation they were having down in a valley, and
okay.
they just set five of us on top of a hill.
Okay.
And we were calling in artillery over us into the valley over there, which
mm-hmm.
was that was something else. They'd have short rounds and they would hit the mountain.
Mm.
We had to call it in then duck.
Right.
But that was another mission they gave us.
Mm-hmm.
We always said, I think there's somebody up there just thinking up stuff, you know, for us to do.
Right. Right. And was it... Do you guys operate basically in the same area there in Three Corps at Tainan, or was it a little bit different area?
I'm not really sure where we operated, but
okay.
I would assume it's fairly close around in it. It was in Three Corps, and
okay.
I believe it was around Tainan because they, I don't know where the Parrish Peak is.
Okay.
And we were right on the Cambodian border.
Mm-hmm.
We operate in that area right up in there.
Mm-hmm.
Fairly close to, I think it was the 25th Division had an AO that was close to us. The only reason I know that is their 25th Division, one of their Cobras fired on us one time because they picked up a sensor they dropped in the wrong place.
Mm-hmm.
So I would assume that's who was right next to us over there.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
It's not, it wasn't a good feeling to get strafed by a Cobra.
Sure, I bet. I bet. All right. Well, we've come up on that 2-hour limit for today. If you don't mind, if we go ahead and take a break for today.
Okay.
All right.
Sounds good.
This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Thomas Ray. Today is June 24th, 2010, and this is interview session number 2. Okay, one of the things I want to start off with today, if we could, I had some questions about the email that you sent me, the write-up that you made about your tours of duty.
Okay.
First of all, I know you mentioned in the email, you talked about a mission where you guys rescued some Montagnard prisoners. Could you talk a little bit about that for the interview?
Yeah. Let me pull that up. And what they had done, I guess, is from what I remember anyway, but Intel had come up with a report that either the VC or the NVA had some Montagnards in their, I guess, in their base camp, and they were using them pretty much as just prisoners or slaves or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave us an approximate, grid coordinate. So what they did is they sent a team of us in there, to check it out.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it was close to a river. I remember that, and when we came up on it, we saw some Montagnards out there in the village, and we pretty much just kind of snuck up on the edge there and trying to see how many VC and NVA it was before we just went into the village and everything. And
right.
After recon it for a little while, there weren't that many. I forget, probably 5, 6, 7 that we actually saw. So what we did, we just assaulted the village pretty much, and trying to distinguish between, well, it was pretty easy to distinguish between Montagnards and VC or NVA.
Mm-hmm.
By the how they were dressed.
So. Right.
And so we got in there, and we rounded up all the Montagnards that they had prisoner there, and called in, and they sent a Chinook. We established a landing zone.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent a Chinook in there, and we rounded all of them up, and they loaded them in the Chinook and took them back, I'm not sure where, to a relocation place wherever they were taking them.
Mm-hmm.
But and that was pretty much what it was.
Right.
I just remember one thing, the Montagnards, we didn't really have anybody that spoke their language, and we were trying to get them onto the Chinook, and they really were pretty apprehensive about getting on the Chinook. They didn't understand what that was.
Right.
So I think somebody said later on they were thinking that it was a big bird and it was swallowing them up, when it was going in the back of it, but they actually got them in there somehow.
Right.
And got them all in.
Uh-huh. About how many Montagnards was it?
Let's see. They pretty much loaded up the Chinook, so it,
okay,
it was probably, I'd say, maybe 20 to 30.
Okay.
I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Was this when you were with the 199th?
somewhere?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. They were a little concerned about getting on the Chinook, huh? But I assume that they were happy to see you guys, though.
Well, yeah, as much as we could tell. Of course, you know, the mountain yards, they were pretty much, the guys, they wore loincloths, and the women, of course, didn't have anything on up top. And
right.
I remember they had, some of them had little crossbows that they had made. I mean, it was pretty primitive. They were pretty primitive people.
Right.
You know. So we were all kind of, that was the first time. I guess that was the first time we had been around any particular mountain yards.
Mm-hmm. All right. another question I had based on the email that you sent me, and I know you talked about it a little bit before, but you talked about Lieutenant O.B. Adams being one of the best officers that you had worked with. I guess could you talk a little bit more about that, about what was it that made him such a good officer?
Well, I guess the main thing was he just kind of fit in with everybody, and I mean, he just, as far as when we were, you know, he would take guard with us. I mean, he was just, he was really, I don't know how you would say it, but he you know, you felt secure in his leadership.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he was real decisive in what he did, and you could tell that he, you know, he knew what he was doing. And
right.
It just made everybody else that was in the team or the squad, you know, they felt secure around
mm-hmm.
him. Which we didn't with some of the other ones that we work with.
Right.
But he pretty much let everybody do what they were supposed to do, and he really, you know, he would, I don't know, he made real good decisions as far as in combat and everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. About how long did you work with him?
Gosh, that's you know, I'm not real sure. I know.
Okay.
You know, I didn't even know what month it was over there.
Sure.
As far as, you know, what day it was or month, you know, we'd come back and I'd ask, you know, what month it was.
Mm-hmm.
But I would assume he was with us 3-4 months, maybe 3 months.
Okay. Right. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Another thing you mentioned was, and I think we talked about this a little bit the last time. I can't completely remember, but a little bit about one of your duties was prisoner snatches.
Right.
And I guess could you talk a little bit more about how that actually worked, how you would get a prisoner?
Well, it's pretty much just what it says, a prisoner snatch. We would we pretty much just find a good spot, you know, where we could be you know, off a what they call a hot trail. In other
okay.
words, we get through, they would say take a prisoner from a certain area.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go through the area, find a what they call a hot trail, one that had been, you know, you could tell it was being used every day or so.
Mm-hmm.
And we would just set up on the trail, actually, and just wait for one to come by that we thought we could snatch. And we'd pretty much just snatch them up
mm-hmm.
and just haul butt with them.
All right.
Yeah, and we would have a predetermined LZ, and we would bundle them up and put them on the chopper, and they'd take them back to intel. I've actually got a picture of one that we took,
mm-hmm.
one of the prisoners.
Right.
And if I could find a way to scan it, I'd send it to you. I didn't know how those other pictures turned out.
Oh, they turned out well, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I've got a picture of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
One of the prisoners, if I can get them scanned in, I'll send them to you.
All right. I appreciate that. Now, would you guys always grab one if it was just a solitary guy by himself, or?
Yeah, and, you know, it was kind of, you know, you never really knew what was going on. In fact, this one that I've got a picture of, when we snatched him, he was actually a lead element of a company-size force.
Right.
And, of course, we didn't know it. You know, a lot of times they would travel in just small packs, you know, maybe 3-4, something like that, and that's who we would try to take, you know, maybe eliminate all but one and take him. But
okay.
We actually took this one, and come to find out, there was about a company behind him, so we pretty much had to grab him and be on our way very quickly because the company was coming up behind him.
Right.
And so we actually got out of there. But, yeah, it was a lot of stuff, I guess, being on working in small teams and stuff, you know, you see a lot of stuff. You know, you talk to people that were over there the whole time and never actually even saw a VC or an NBA. Just about every time we went out, we saw them, I guess, because we were operating kind of like them, and we were quiet and silent when we went through the jungle and stuff, so you'd end up running right into them a lot of times. So that happened quite often.
Right. Well, given the fact that you guys observe them quite a bit, whereas typical line units, you know, as you said, wouldn't see them very often, but you guys would see a lot of them. Just observing them, how did they operate out in the field? Were they very cautious in the way they moved?
Well, yeah. Sometimes it actually depended on where you were. A lot of times we were in places where you could tell that they had no idea there were any U.S. troops in the area.
Okay.
You know, this is, I guess, when I was with the first calf, because we were working in five-man teams. We sat there and counted like 75 just walked by us. We've seen them move at night. We've seen just different things. I mean, it was just stuff that I guess we were pretty quiet getting into the area, and they never suspected we were there. Now, if they ever did suspect that there was a small team in the area, they would send everything they had trying to either kill that team or to capture somebody. I guess there was a big bounty on us at that time, and we've had some pretty hairy incidents with that, you know, trying to, you know, we crawled on our belly over 100 yards one time trying to get away from them. What happened is we'd taken a shot at one of them a pretty good ways off, and I guess they sent a team trying to hunt us down. They figured out it was a small team, and we pretty much had to crawl on our bellies about 100 yards and really try to escape because they were trying to surround us at the time, but we actually got loose.
Right. Was this the incident that you mentioned in the email, I guess, where they sent quite a few after you guys? Okay.
Yeah, it probably was, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. All right. a few other incidents that you mentioned, if you could talk a little bit about. I know you talked about there was a time whenever you guys actually set off some sensors and were strafed.
Yeah, it was actually our area of operation bordered the 25th Division. I'm pretty sure that's who it was. That's who they told us it was anyway.
Okay.
But we were operating, I think it was right there on the Cambodian border. What happened was they sent these little sensors out. They looked like a piece of dog mess or something, you know, like wooden, I think was what they were supposed to be. We actually saw them, but we figured they were ours, and everybody knew, and they were supposed to know where we were.
Right.
And when we were walking down the trail, we actually saw them. And as we went by, then we heard some gunships coming on, you know, flying over, and we didn't really think anything of it until they, you know, they strafed the area where they were, which was right there where we were.
Right.
And, of course, when they did that, we, you know, we started running, and we found a river with a high bank on it, and we jumped down into the river and just pretty much just pasted ourselves against the wall there, you know, against the bank of the river until he finished. I think he strafed us two or three times.
Oh, wow. Right.
Yeah, some of the guys were going, you know, hell, I'm going to go out there and shoot his butt down. Nah, it's probably not a good idea. They might have everything on us then. So we didn't. We just pretty much just waited. And, you know, he went off station. Of course, we were calling back to our headquarters, and they were in turn calling, I guess, division, trying to find out, you know, what gunship was in the area and why they were firing us up. And they couldn't. They said they didn't have any in the area, so apparently they figured out it was it must have been the 25th Division that was bordering our AO over there. And I guess they'd put the sensors out in the wrong place, which was common over there.
Right.
You know. So finally they called them off. sound like you got a cold.
Yeah, I've got a little bit of one, unfortunately. I've had it for a while. It's still hanging in there. Won't quite go away.
Yeah.
Right. All right. Another few incidents. I know you talked about there was a morning when you came across a wounded NVA female. Could you talk about that?
We were set up one night, and you know you hear all kind of things out in the jungle anyway. But we heard moaning, and you know that's what we were saying. It sounded like a female, you know, crying or something. But we figured it was either a tiger or some type of a cat that was in the, you know, that kind of sound alike, I guess, because we'd heard everything out there.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't think much about it, but then the next morning we heard it again, and we went over there to investigate, and it was an NVA female.
Mm-hmm.
I think later on they said she was a nurse.
Okay.
That I guess had been with a bunch of the NVA when they got caught in an ambush. Not our ambush, but I'm not sure who. But anyway, but she was laying on the ground. She wasn't armed at that time, and we went up there, and our medics went over there to treat her and try to find out exactly what it was. And they turned her over, and I think it was her right cheek of her butt back here was completely blown off.
Mm-hmm.
I guess looked like maybe a claymore or something, or somebody had shot her through it.
Right.
And it looked like they put maggots in there, I guess somebody said later, to eat the dead flesh.
Mm-hmm.
And everything. So we did everything we could for her, and then we medevaced her back.
Right.
Out of there. But it was, yeah.
Was that, did that happen on other occasions where you'd find a wounded enemy soldier? And was there any other incidents?
I guess that was probably the only time we've ever found one like that.
Okay.
And there wasn't anybody else around, so I don't know if they were just in a hurry and they just left her behind, or if she was the only one left. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Another incident you mentioned was being stuck out in the field as a result of a typhoon.
Yeah. I'm assuming it was a typhoon. You know, I didn't really.
Okay.
We didn't have the Weather Channel back then.
Right.
But what happened? It was either that, a tropical storm, or something. I have no idea. Of course,
mm-hmm.
this was in I don't know what month it was in '70. I was going to look back and see if they actually did have a typhoon hit over there during that time. But they'd sent us out on a mission, and I forgot what the mission was. But it was supposed to be a 5-day mission. Was our usual routine. And,
right.
On about the fourth or fifth day, the weather kind of started, you know, turning bad, which was unusual during that time. And so we called back and to see if they were going to extract us. And they said, well, they were going to extract us in the next morning. So, you know, we gave them where we were and everything like that. And what happened was, I guess the weather came in a little early, and it grounded all the aircraft. So
mm-hmm.
we were stuck out there for, I can't remember if it was 2 or 3 days out there, and it rained for 2 solid days just as hard, I guess, as it could. I mean, you couldn't even see the person across from you and everything. It was just, we had to move to higher ground on the side of a mountain or hill up there to try to get out of the water. I mean, it was flooding everywhere.
Oh, wow.
And,
right.
Yeah. We usually took 2 radios with us. And both the radios got wet, and they quit working. I mean, everything was just soaked. Of course, all we had was a poncho, and that was it, you know,
right
there. So there wasn't too much sleep. But it was pretty miserable. Got up the next day, we couldn't make contact to try to get picked up. So pretty much out there for 2 days with nothing, no commo, no nothing. And finally, I think on the third day, what we did is we had claymores with us, and we just broke up the claymore, got the C4 out of the back of it, and lit it, and held the radios over it to dry them out and everything. We finally got one radio working with, I think we had one battery left, and we finally got in touch so that we could tell them where we were and to get a pickup point where they could come get us. But, whew, that's pretty miserable, I tell you.
Right.
You know,
Had you guys had enough food and supplies to last that time, or had you run out by that point?
No, we had run out. Mm-hmm. You know, if you pack for a 5-day mission, I mean, you pack just the bare necessities. Usually, I wouldn't pack but one meal, really, one good meal. Good meals with sea rations, or either lurps, either one. But we had those in the evening, and just some fruit or something like that, and that was pretty much it. So you didn't take anything extra, because that was just extra weight in your rucksack, you know. Mm-hmm. So no, we'd given out of food and everything.
Right. Right.
So.
All right.
But we had some choice words for them when we got back. I don't think it did anything.
Any other memorable moments from either unit that we should mention before moving on?
I think I told you about, you know, when I had first gotten over there with a 199th, and I was walking a point there. I think we'd already gone over that when I ran into them.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't think of anything.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, let's see. Did you get a chance to go on R&R during your tour?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
I went on R&R to Thailand, to Bangkok.
Okay.
Yeah. Most of the single soldiers, that's where they went there, or I think it was Manila in the Philippines, or... Most of the married people went to Hawaii to mm-hmm. meet their wives and stuff. But
right.
Most of the guys who wanted to have a good time went to Thailand or somewhere.
Sure.
Very good time, yeah.
Right.
Very good.
All right. And that was a week? Was that a week?
Yeah.
Okay.
1 week.
All right.
Yeah.
Did that come pretty late in your tour?
Yeah. I took it almost at the end. I think I'd been over there 10 months before I took off.
Okay.
What it did is you were pretty much assured of getting an R&R slot if the later that you were over there. In other words, they did it by how much time you had in country.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, and you could actually take an R&R and one leave, I think, a week leave, but I never got to take leave. I put in for a week leave to go to Australia, but I couldn't go because of the operations going on. They couldn't spare me to leave, so
mm-hmm.
I ended up just getting the R&R.
Right. All right. Okay, just a few more questions here about this part of your tour. Did you guys ever participate in any kind of civic action or MedCap things at all? Anything like that?
No.
Okay.
We actually didn't.
All right.
Now, we had operated one time. I'm not sure. I guess it was a bunch of, I'm not sure the specifics on it, but we did take some, a local, I guess it would have been a platoon size element out. And we were actually the radio communications for them.
Okay.
They were, for lack of a word, I guess they were mercenaries.
Okay.
Yeah, and a lot of times they would send us out for radio relay, just a team of us out for them, and we mm-hmm. pretty much just traveled with them and for whatever they had to do. Mm-hmm. Usually go into villages and destroy the villages, and I think they got to keep whatever they whatever they found or whatever.
Right. How would you guys be able to communicate with them?
Well, you know, I don't remember right offhand. I guess there's a lot of I don't know that we I think they had one guy that spoke English.
Okay.
One guy, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And we pretty much just I think we were there most to make sure that they knew where we were at any one time, you know, or either if we had to call in artillery or gunships or
right
if anybody got in trouble and stuff. We had taken out some other than that, we took out some Arvin Rangers before. that were, I guess, out of school.
Okay.
And a lot of times they would get us just to take them out on missions and stuff.
Right.
Just, I think what their commander said, try to take them out and get them bloody.
Mm.
In other words, get them some combat experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they would send us out with them.
Right. All right. Well, anything else we should mention before discussing the end of your tour and coming home?
No, I can't think of anything.
Okay. All right. Well, what was out processing like? Did you come out of the field any time before? Did you come out of the field like a time period before your tour came to an end, or was it almost up to the last day that you were still operating in the field?
Yeah, well, most, I think most of the people, they would actually give them a break before the end of the tour.
Mm-hmm.
I never did get a chance to take it. I think we were very short on people at that time, and I actually stayed in the field until I think it was one day before I was set to leave.
Oh, wow.
And I came out of the field, got to the fire base, gathered up my stuff, and went back to the rear to go home.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any of the short-timer syndrome concern that something could happen there at the last few days?
Yeah, I did. Mm-hmm. Probably that first, last, I don't know if it was a month or weeks or whatever, I don't even think I slept. I swear, I stayed up the whole time. I think when you first get over there, you have this attitude that I'm going to be over here for a year, and you're really not that scared at all.
Right.
And you just pretty much take stuff as it goes, and the closer you get toward the end of your tour, it seems that you start thinking about stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. So did it make you, I guess, act more careful and more aware? Or?
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay.
Like I say, I was in pretty bad shape. I knew I couldn't sleep at all, so I mm-hmm. ended up taking a lot of people's guard at night, you know, just because I couldn't sleep anyway, so.
Right.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
All right. Well, I think we talked about this last time a little bit, but about not really having an idea of the bigger picture of the war. But by the time you left, did you have any thoughts about the way the war was going? Did you think that we were winning, we were losing, or how the war was going?
I never really had any thoughts about that. I think the only thing I was concerned with was trying to stay alive and trying to make sure that my team stayed alive.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty much that's all you're fighting for.
Mm-hmm.
It's just for your, you know, just the team that you're with. You know, that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a job. You go out there and try not to get killed and try to keep your other buddies from getting killed.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
That's pretty much it. I had no idea, you know, about that. I knew that as far as fighting the war over there, that it was a lot more productive to use small teams than it was for company-size elements.
Mm-hmm.
Just from the fact that, you know, our kill ratio was about, 50, 100 times more than the company level.
Oh, wow.
Our five-man team probably, we probably had a kill ratio of all the rest of the companies combined.
Oh, wow, right.
And probably because we came into contact so much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let me ask it this way. How was the trip home? What was that like? And how did, and this may be a silly question, but how did you feel about leaving?
Well, I mean, I was ready to get out of there.
Uh-huh.
It's just like, I don't know why you get this feeling, but just like when I was medevaced over there and taken out of the field, you know, when I was wounded and taken back to the rear and stuff, I was actually ready to get back to the team.
You know? Mm-hmm.
I kind of felt like I should be there with them. really wanted to get back. But now, as far as when the ETS came and I was ready to come home, you know, I was pretty much ready to come home.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, I don't remember a whole lot about it.
Right.
You know, I remember getting on the plane. I mean, it was pretty, like I say, I mean, I came straight out of the field, straight back to the rear, and I think we had khakis back then, and they had us a set of khakis with whatever. And I remember going through the medal ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
When you got there, you know, to put on your uniform and stuff, which you just came down a line and they just threw them in a bag for you. And
mm-hmm.
you put whatever on, and then I think I landed in Japan on the way back.
All right.
And then back in into California.
Okay. What was your homecoming like? Did you run into any war protests or anything like that?
I really didn't. I mean, when we got to California, we saw a few, but I actually never, you know, came one-on-one on anybody that said anything to me.
Mm-hmm.
As far as protesting the war.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably a good thing.
Right.
Because I don't imagine I would have been in any mood to actually listen to them or anything.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
But I was trying to think. It was one of the guys that was on our team. We came back at the same time. And when we hit, we came into San Francisco, and I pretty much just threw all my clothes and everything away, or whatever I had in my bag, and just got on the plane for coming home. And there were some guys there recruiting. I'm not really sure who they were or what they were recruiting for, but come to find out, I think they were recruiting for people to come back to go to, I don't know if it was CIA who it was recruiting.
Mm, right.
They were recruiting folks. I think they were going into Laos. And,
okay.
A buddy of mine that came back with me, he went over. They came over to talk to us, and I just said, you know, no, I'm going home. I don't know what you want, but
right.
You know, I'm going home. But my friend, his last name was Clark. He was from Kentucky.
Okay.
He actually talked to him, and I think he ended up going back with him. So I have no idea whatever happened to him after that.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Well, how about when you got back, when you actually got back home, did you go back home to Alabama at that point?
Yeah, I did. Okay. I flew into Montgomery.
All right. How about your reception there?
It was just my family
there.
I mean, I got back, it was like nobody knew what was going on, you know. It wasn't like there was even a war going on.
Right.
You know, even people that I saw, it was kind of like, you know, everything had been going on. It was like nothing, I guess, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was no homecoming, no nothing, you know.
Right.
Quite different than what it is nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, had you, I know you later on ended up getting back into the Army, but had you gotten out by that point? Were you finished with the Army at that point? Or?
No, I actually left there, and I was on leave for a while, and then I went back. I still had time left.
Okay.
And I went back to Fort Hood, Texas. That's where I was assigned to. I actually came back from, when I came back from overseas, I really didn't have an assignment.
Okay.
They just said, you know, go home and we'll send you your assignment on where you're going to go to next, and I really didn't know, so
mm-hmm.
I just went home, and they actually called later on. And they had assigned me to Fort Hood, Texas, where I didn't even know where Fort Hood, Texas was.
Right.
At that time. So.
All right. Well, what was your assignment there?
At Fort Hood?
Yeah.
Well, when I got there, with my MOS, I was, I guess I was, my MOS was 11F, which is Operations Intel, and I think the only ones that had that MOS was either Special Forces or Rangers.
Okay.
So I came to Fort Hood, and they were going to put me in the Ranger company that they had there at Fort Hood. And, you know, I had just a little bit of time left, and I went, no. I knew it was voluntary, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, no, I don't really want to be assigned to a Ranger, you know, because I'm not staying in, and I don't really want to, you know, do a bunch of hoo-ah stuff. I'm just trying to
Right.
Do my time and get out. Mm-hmm. So after that, they tried to find out what they could assign me to with that MOS. So they actually assigned me to the 2nd Armor Division in a what they call an Armor Recon or an Armor Scout.
Okay.
So they assigned me to that as the platoon sergeant.
Okay.
So I was actually a platoon sergeant of stuff I had no idea what it was. I'd never even driven one, ridden one, or whatever. So.
Right.
But that's what I was ended up being platoon sergeant as.
Mm-hmm. How long did that assignment last before you were done?
I'm not sure. It wasn't. Okay. I don't think it was. Was it a year? It might have been a year, I guess.
Okay.
I had a 3-year commitment, so it was whatever was left after my tour over there. Probably close to a year. I got out early, 3 months early, to go to school.
Okay. Did you have, if you don't mind me asking this question, did you have any difficulty in transitioning back to, I guess, life outside of the combat zone?
Yeah. I had a lot of problems with it.
Okay.
Yeah. Which it was a lot of... A lot of drinking,
mm-hmm.
a lot of whatever else, you know, that came about.
Right.
There's a lot of drug use, a lot of drinking, mm-hmm. All of that. It was pretty much, morale was pretty much as low as you could get back then,
mm-hmm.
when you came back. There was no, you know, like they do now with post-traumatic stress disorder, I'm sure. I probably had that, but
okay.
Like I say, I cured it with 2 years with a bottle of tequila every year for 2 years, and that pretty much cured it up. I don't know if it burnt the brain cells out or what, but
mm-hmm.
yeah, it was pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
Had a tough time for a while.
So it took you about 2 years to adjust?
Yeah, at least.
Okay. All right. And you know, you said that after you got out of the military, you went to college, you went to school at that point?
Yeah.
Okay, where'd you go to school?
I went to Troy State.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, the reason I ended up at Troy State, I had applied to different places, but Troy State, if you went there, they were on a quarter system, and I'd applied and was accepted at the University of Texas, at Troy State, and University of Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
Texas and Alabama was on a semester system.
Right.
Troy was at that time under a quarter system. So, if I went to Troy, I got out of school. I got out of the Army 3 months early. So, that's how I ended up at Troy.
Okay. All right. What did you major in there?
At that time, I was majoring in business.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I was pretty much majoring in partying.
Yeah. Right. Was there any type of anti-war things going on there at Troy?
No.
Okay. All right. So did you end up finishing up and getting a degree there?
Well, I actually went to Troy, and I ended up transferring to University of Alabama at Birmingham.
Okay.
Yeah, and I came out of there. I was a registered respiratory therapist.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And after. I guess timeline-wise, what year would this have been?
Jeez. I started, I actually went to Troy for a few years. I stayed out for a year and worked. I came back to Texas and took a job, a construction job for a year to save up money, and then I came back to Troy.
Okay.
So it was probably over a span from like 5 years, from 72 to 77, something like that.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah, and I went to school on GI Bill.
All right.
Well, yeah.
During this time, as the war in Vietnam was winding down, did you pay any attention to what was going on?
Well, a little bit, whatever I saw on the news and stuff. And, you know, they were saying, back then they were saying, you know, that the U.S. was pulling out, they were pulling troops out, and that the South Vietnamese were going to take over. My only comment was, I said, well, as soon as they pull out and the South Vietnamese take over, the North Vietnamese will take over the country.
Mm-hmm.
Which I pretty much knew that.
Right.
You know, and everybody else is going, well, how do you know that? I said, well, I know the South Vietnamese and how they fight.
Mm-hmm. Right. How did you feel about that?
Well, I didn't have any feelings one way or the other.
Okay.
I really didn't. Mm-hmm. I was just glad to have finished.
Right.
Gotten out. So.
How about when the war came to a conclusion with the fall of Saigon? Did you have any feelings about that at that point?
No, I really didn't. It was just something that I expected and figured it was going to happen anyway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I knew it was just a matter of time once the U.S. pulled out. You know, I think it might have happened a little bit quicker than I thought, but it came to the same conclusion that I figured was going to happen anyway.
Right, right. Okay. And also during this time period, after you had come back when the war was still going on, did you talk to anyone about Vietnam? Was anyone interested in it?
The only ones I talked to were some friends of mine that were going to Troy that were Vietnam veterans.
Okay.
That was the only guys that I talked to. Nobody else actually, they really didn't know anything about it. I mean, you know, it's like, I don't know. They really didn't know what to ask or anything else. I mean, it was the only person you could actually talk to about it was another Vietnam veteran.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the only ones that actually understood.
Right. All right. Well, I guess getting back to the chronology of your career and all, after you graduated from college, what did you do at that point?
Well, I got a job, and let's see, I got married in between there to my first wife.
Okay.
And I moved back to Troy, and mm-hmm. I was the cardiopulmonary manager there at the hospital.
Okay.
And I started there, and I stayed there for, 19 years, I think.
Mm. Okay.
And I was married for about 2 years and got a divorce.
Well, when did you decide to get back into the Army, and what made you decide to do that?
Well, it was, I'm not real sure. I think I was just sitting around at one time, you know, and just saying, and I was looking around to see if anything actually had anything that was fairly close to what I had done over there, you know, as far as MOS.
Mm-hmm.
And the only ones actually that had anything or had the same MOS was the 20th Special Forces. They had a National Guard unit in Alabama. So I actually joined with them. And I think it was 81
the
first time. Yeah, and I stayed with them about 4 to 5 years. And then I got married again. And actually, that was taking up a lot of time with the Special Forces. It's not just a weekend and 2 weeks a year for sure. So
mm-hmm.
I ended up getting out then, or I guess going like inactive.
Right.
And I stayed out for, I don't know, it was about a year. And actually a friend of mine talked me into getting in another National Guard unit that was getting ready to go to Panama. So
okay.
I said, well, never been to Panama, so I went back and joined up with them and went to Panama.
Mm-hmm. All right. What were your duties there?
Actually, with the Special Forces, I was the medic. Special Forces.
All right.
Yeah, I was the assistant team medic.
Okay. All right.
And when I got back out, I got in, and there was a unit that was close to home, but they were a transportation unit, so.
Mm-hmm.
I actually got in there, and they put me in charge of the arms room. I was the armorer.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Was there any difficulty in getting back in, and did you have to undergo any further training or anything like that?
When I got back in the Special Forces, I'd never been through airborne training, although I was supposed to have been before I went to Vietnam. I was supposed to go to airborne training, but
mm-hmm.
they never sent me. So when I got in Special Forces, I went ahead and went off airborne training.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And some the medic training that
Right, right. So did you actually participate in the operation in Panama?
No, this was actually beforehand. This was in 85.
Okay.
It was, I guess it was a humanitarian mission down there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
I was actually down there. I've been to Panama, I think, 4 different times.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. You say a humanitarian mission. What type of things were you guys doing?
They were building a road from one side of Panama to the other.
Okay.
And we were actually hauling supplies and stuff up there and doing whatever needed to be done. We were, I think it was, we were hauling whatever they needed. There was engineer units down there, and they were building schools, building a road and stuff for the to actually be able to get from one side of Panama to the other.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Any other memorable type operations or things you guys did prior to getting into the more recent conflicts with in 2003 with Iraq that we should mention?
No, I went to Honduras also.
Okay.
I was over in Honduras doing pretty much the same thing. They sent me down there to be, I guess, like a liaison. I had to get all the equipment from the, that was when they were taking equipment down there to Honduras and trying to get it up. They were doing another humanitarian mission.
Okay.
We had to get the equipment over a couple of mountains over there to some base camps that we set up on the El Salvadorian border.
Okay.
And that's pretty much what I did then.
All right.
I was at Sotocana Air Base, and we would get the equipment there and take it across over into the to the other bases, which was about a day's drive.
Mm-hmm. All right. But did you, once you got out and got back in again, did you stay in that whole time up until recently, or?
Yeah, once I got back in 1985, I pretty much stayed in until now.
Okay.
Yeah, without a split then.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any other deployments before getting to Iraq?
Not that I can think of. I think it was about 4 times I went to Panama and Honduras, and I was trying to think if I went anywhere else.
Okay.
Not that I can think of.
All right. Well, I guess moving on to Iraq then, in 2003, when did you receive orders? Was it at the beginning of the war that you received orders to go there, or?
Yeah, our unit was actually mobilized February.
Okay.
In February. And from there, we went to, at this time I was with a, what they call an area support group.
Okay.
Out of Mobile.
All right.
And we were mobilized, I think it was February the 10th, and we went to Fort Benning, Georgia to mobilize out of there. And that was when you had a little bit of, pre-training before you went over there. And mostly at that time it was chemical training and stuff because, you know, they thought that Saddam was going to slime us when we went over there. So.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's pretty much it. Weapons qualification, chemical training, that was about all we had. Some of us actually went to some different schools over there because there was a lot of downtime when they were trying to get everybody over there. When Turkey closed the border,
right.
We probably would have been over there. We were supposed to have gone into northern Iraq.
Okay.
But once Turkey closed the border over there, it kind of changed things up and kind of backed everything up.
Right.
That was going over there, so.
All right.
Yeah.
So did you arrive in Kuwait then? Is that where?
Yeah, we flew into Kuwait International at that time, and we were moved to Arifjan, which is a base in Kuwait.
All right.
Yeah.
What were your early impressions of Kuwait?
Pretty hot.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we got there at night. At that time, they were flying at night and stuff. They weren't coming in the daytime. They were still shooting rockets over into Kuwait. They actually shot, I'm not sure how many. There was a couple of rockets shot from Iraq into Kuwait at the time when we got over there. One hit one of the malls back there. And, of course, we still had, we had our J-List, which is a chemical suit, and our mask and everything like that we had to carry around with us at all times. Really not a whole lot. I mean, it was just people everywhere. We got there, there wasn't anywhere as far as for anybody to stay, so all they did is they just crammed everybody into some buildings they had there. It was like warehouses, and that's where everybody was housed, in the warehouse.
All right. Were the how about your impressions of the Kuwaitis, if you had any interaction at all with them? Were they friendly? Or?
Well, I really didn't have any contact with them when I first got there. Later on, I did.
Okay.
I got to be friends with one guy that was a Kuwaiti over there.
Okay.
And actually went out and he had a place on the Persian Gulf over there, and I actually went out and ate with him and a couple other of his friends who was part of the royal family.
Okay.
What happened when I went over there with the mobile unit, they were supposed to have gone up into Iraq and some kind of deal. Somebody else went, so they didn't really have a job for them up there. So they stayed in at Erifjan as kind of a mayor cell, in other words, running Erifjan.
Okay.
And I didn't have a job. I was in, like, Host Nation. Host Nation is the ones that go out there and we contract services and stuff like that.
Okay.
And so there was a theater support group over there that wanted us to come work with them. It was the 377th TSC, which was in charge of the whole theater, Iraq, Afghanistan, everything else. So we actually went over to their cell that they were working out of, which was a different cell.
Okay.
And so we started working for them, and from there, they started up a. This was when all the coalition forces were coming into, you know, when President Bush was, you know, when he had all these countries that were going to come into Iraq. In other words, you know, which was a true coalition force.
Right.
And they really didn't have anybody that was in charge of the coalition forces, so they formed a task force from some people there, and I volunteered for the task force.
Okay.
And so that's how I got on the task force Gator, which had to do with all of the coalition forces coming into Kuwait and Iraq.
Mm-hmm. All right. What were some of the other nations that you, or some of the troops from the other nations that you were working with, where were they from?
Gosh, we had 37 countries.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. The ones that we had the most interaction with, I guess, was the Latin American countries, which was El Salvador, Nicaragua. We had Dominican Republic over there. We did a lot of work with the some of the Eastern European countries, Latvia.
Okay.
It was a slew of them. I mean, it was actually 37 of them.
Wow, right.
It was the Polish. You know, Iraq was divided up into different sections, and
right.
The ones that we mainly worked with was what they called MND Central South, which was Multinational Division Central South, which extended from around just south of Baghdad all the way down to the border with the Brits, who had the southern part around Basra.
Mm-hmm.
So we went all the way through Babylon to Nazaria, on up to Al-Qud on the Iranian border, all the way over to Karbala and everything in the central part. So we had all of the forces that were going within that section.
All right. Were there any problems between the different nations as far as getting along, or did they all seem to get along and cooperate pretty well?
Yeah, I don't know if I can really talk about that. How many years has that been?
Not too long. About 7 years, I guess. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, there were problems. Some of the nations didn't get along with others.
Mm-hmm.
I can suffice to say that. But
okay.
The Polish were actually in charge of MND, Central South. So that's pretty much who we worked with as a command. And under them, you had the Ukraine. We worked a lot with the Ukrainian soldiers over there. They probably had the second most soldiers over there behind Poland.
All right.
And then the Latin Americans were actually, all of the Latin American countries were actually under the Spanish. There was a Spanish brigade over there.
Okay.
And they actually fell under the Spanish brigade, probably because of language, is the only thing I can figure.
Right, right.
They weren't too pleased about that. If you know how the Spanish feel about, I guess, people from other countries other than Spain.
Right.
They don't get along that well.
Yeah, and that old history of colonialism and all.
Right,
so,
right.
And, sure.
I guess, the El Salvadorians, we did a lot of work with them.
Okay.
The Nicaraguans we had some with, and all of the other ones, but El Salvadorians, I really enjoyed working with them. It was a good group. Most of them were their actual best soldiers that they had in the country at the time, which a lot of them were Special Forces soldiers, had been trained by the U.S. Special Forces.
All right. Right. Other types of duties? I think you mentioned in the email something about convoy duty as well.
Yeah. What we did is we pretty much had, we did everything for the coalition troops that they needed.
Okay.
They needed. And in fact, when they come in country, they didn't have all of the supplies and everything that they needed. So it was our job to find out what they needed and get it to them.
Okay.
That was pretty much it. So what we ended up doing, the State Department would email me with a request, or actually I would get in touch with them and tell them what they needed, and they would in turn usually send the supplies directly to me to be put in a warehouse in Kuwait.
Okay.
And from that I would fill orders in that and take convoys up there to the different nations and stuff and distribute the supplies and stuff. They ended up getting a lot of uniforms that we had, the old the desert camos and stuff.
Yeah.
We ended up giving those boots, even from helmets to, all kind of anything that you would actually need up there. And it's according to it's an ACSA agreement, and this is an agreement between the U.S. and that country that we will sell them supplies at the U.S. cost.
All right.
So, it's not like they were given to them, but I'm sure
right.
they were. But and so we pretty much did that. We went into the different areas. We would take the coalition forces up into Iraq to whatever base they were going to go into, and we would actually try to advise them on certain stuff they need to do there as far as security.
Mm-hmm.
Try to get them communication with everybody. Pretty much just trying to get them coordinated and everything with the Polish and trying to get them, set so they could do their mission.
Right, right.
So we ended up having to run the convoys back and forth up there. Usually one convoy would take about 10 days by the time we went to all the different places.
Okay.
So.
Right. Any, at this point, was there much danger involved with that? Would you guys come under fire from insurgents?
Yeah, we pretty much came under fire every time we went on a convoy.
Okay.
But most of it was not, it wasn't like a firefight like I was accustomed to. But
right.
Most of the time it was just some of them either getting on top of the buildings and stuff and shooting at us from the top of the building and ducking and hiding. It wasn't like a coordinated attack most of the time.
Right. Okay.
We did have a few problems over toward Alcoot when they were more organized over in toward the Iranian border, and they were probably Iranians, is what they were saying they were.
Mm,
it had come across the border when the U.S. invaded. But we came, I mean, it was just mostly small arms fire
right.
that we came under most of the time. Other than that, the IEDs were there, but they were actually pretty primitive at that time.
Okay.
You could usually spot them.
Right.
You just had to be cautious on your convoys.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. As far as small arms fire, was it primarily things like AK-47s and
right.
stuff like
yeah.
that? Any RPGs and things like that as well, or?
They shot a couple of RPGs at us once. We were inside of a base one time, and they went through we had some what they call Texas barriers, which is those big concrete barriers.
Okay.
Yeah, they hit the concrete barriers and they hit a building behind us over there. They pretty much tried to, or I guess at that time when they were getting organized, they tried to target the coalition forces, because that was a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Right.
Target the coalition forces to get them, you know, to try to pull out and stuff and make the U.S. be the only ones there. So that was a big thing with them.
Right.
Okay. Intel on that.
All right. And would the convoy's response be to just keep moving?
Well, or? You know, the rules of engagement changed numerous times while I was over there.
Okay.
When we first went out there, it was, hey, you shoot anybody that's got a weapon.
Okay.
And so it changed from that to, you know, you can't shoot anybody with a weapon unless they're pointing it at you.
Mm-hmm.
And change from that is you can't shoot them unless they're shooting at you.
Mm, right.
So, we actually operated, we were under control of the 1st MEF, the Marine Corps.
Okay.
When we first started the convoys, we had one platoon, a scout sniper platoon attached to us. And between them and us, we provided our own security for the convoys, because it wasn't anybody else.
Mm, right.
And at that time, we went by Marine Corps rules, so if they fired at you, you stopped and pursued.
Okay.
The Army at that time did not pursue.
Mm.
They just ran through.
All right. And on these convoys, what would your specific duty be?
I was actually, once I had my Humvee fixed and I had a 50 cal mounted on that, I was actually the 50 cal gunner up top.
Okay.
Yeah. I was the NCOIC of the whole thing, so pretty much just whatever needed to be done.
Right. Right.
But I was most familiar with heavy weapons and stuff, so I guess I kind of volunteered myself to be the gunner.
Mm-hmm. All right. You mentioned having the Humvees fixed. Could you talk a little bit more about that? I know in the email you talked about not having armor.
When we first went over there, actually in 03, 04, there were very limited up-armored Humvees.
Okay.
That was before they saw fit to get any of the up-armored, and especially the National Guard units, we didn't have anything. We had what we brought with us, which were zero up-armored Humvees.
Mm-hmm.
There just weren't any available. So what we did is we found out, you know, we needed a little more armor, we needed a little more of something on there. So we pretty much did it ourselves. I talked to a guy that had worked with, he worked over at the Anniston Army Depot.
Okay.
And he came up with an idea. I told him I wanted to mount a machine gun on top of my Humvee. So he came up with an idea of putting a metal frame like inside of the Humvee, and putting a what they call a ring mount.
Okay.
On top of it, and we could mount a machine gun on there. So we went with that, and he actually mounted that in there. I got a ring mount, put my 50 cal up on top, and so it was a improvised gun truck.
Right.
Yeah. Right. I'll have to send you a picture of that. It was something else. They did an article about that in the Mobile Press Register.
Okay.
Yeah, they came over there and they saw my. I was trying to think of the guy's name. It's the editor down there at the Press Register.
I can't think of it either.
He came over there a couple of times visiting all the Alabama troops, and at that time he saw that, you know, and he took pictures of and interviewed me about it, you know, and I was just telling him how we, you know, came about fixing it up. But that was commonplace. I mean, there were a lot of people doing that because there just wasn't, you know, there wasn't anything in the supply chain. And you just tried to help yourself the best you could. You know, we put sandbags in the floor, put our some of our Kevlar, if you could find another of your IOTV or your vests and stuff, you'd hang them on the doors if you had any. But, I mean, you know, it was just pretty much do what you had to do.
Right. All right.
Yeah, most of the up-armored were going to the active duty units that were coming in theater.
Okay.
They had them lined up there, but nobody could use them.
Right. All right. Did your Vietnam experience help you at all in Iraq, did you think?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
All right.
I think everybody there had never actually, I guess, been in combat, been in a war zone or anything else. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was one reason that I decided to be up on the 50 cal, because I think I could size up the situation a lot better and know when to fire, when not to fire, and what to do about it. But, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. All right.
I definitely did.
So were there any other Vietnam vets, or were you the only one?
There was one other guy that was in our that had been was over there. He was with the 101st. He was with the 101st over in Vietnam, but
okay.
He had real bad skin cancer, so we just decided we couldn't take him on the convoys because it was just, you know, we were out in the sun all the time. So
right.
It ended up me being the only one that was there. Mm-hmm. The only other one that I met was a Marine Corps colonel. He was a Vietnam vet, Marine Corps.
Okay.
Yeah, Colonel Alan Cruz.
All right. Were you able to, I guess, I don't know, pass on any of your Vietnam experience to the younger guys who hadn't had any combat? Did you talk to them about, I guess, what to expect and that type of thing?
Yeah, I did. In fact, you know, a lot of them didn't have experience on different weapons and stuff, and I tried to train some of them on the 50 caliber machine gun, you know, what to do about that. And there were some times when, you know, they would kind of get too excited, and I would try to calm them down. Sometimes there were different things that would happen, and you know, I would try to give them, you know, a shoot, don't shoot kind of situation, if you know what I mean. It was
right.
There were a lot of things that happened where probably legally you could have gone ahead and shot, but really it wasn't one of those situations where you should have.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We were, our convoy, our Humvee was rammed by a van as we were traveling one time. And, of course, any time, you know, you see a van coming in from the side, and you would think, of course, you know, a V-bid or something. But actually, it was just a stupid Iraqi driver. And
right.
I kind of recognized that because I was up on the 50 cal, and I'd already had a bead on him and was actually getting ready to fire.
Uh-huh.
When I looked at him and saw the guy just wasn't even looking, he ran into it. And my driver saw it at the same time, and he pretty much just swerved over there and clipped him and
right.
ran him up on the curb and wrecked him and everything. And I just kind of shook my finger at him when I went by, you know, like, hey, you were about 2 seconds from being dead.
Right.
But mm-hmm. It was just stuff like that. It was an experience working with the population out there, for sure.
Mm-hmm. What was your impression of them in general, if you could talk a little?
Of the Iraqis?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think they had been under Saddam for so long that they had lost the ability to actually think for themselves and actually try to rationalize what to do. I think that's a big problem with it. We were on a convoy. We came up on where there was a wreck, and I noticed the traffic was just backed up for 2 miles on each side.
Hmm.
You know, that's the one thing you don't want to do is stop.
Right.
So we finally went up there, and we're trying to find out what was going on. And they couldn't figure out how to, you know, move one car, let this line go for a little while, and then stop and let this other line go. I mean, you know, they had I don't know. They just, it's really...
Right.
So finally we actually had to get out, lock and load, and actually put a rifle on somebody and threaten to shoot them if they moved so that we could get the other cars going so that we could get all the traffic going.
Mm.
And so we finally got out and got the traffic moving. I mean, it's just like they have like a, I don't know, it's like a fifth or sixth grade, I wouldn't even say sixth grade, probably a fifth grade education as far as that. And they just, I think they've been told what to do for so long, they have a hard problem trying to figure out what to do.
Right, right.
So, and you see the same thing with their military is kind of like that. They have to have a leader. Showing them exactly what to do all the time.
Right.
They just don't have, can't think on their own.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right.
But.
Well, as far as your interaction with the average Iraqis, did you find at this early point, were they friendly, hostile, somewhere in between?
Well, you know, it really depended on which area you
okay.
were in. A lot of friendly, I mean, they would come out and wave at you and everything, and it seemed like the different sections on where we traveled, you could tell a distinct difference.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were not friendly at all.
Right.
And whereas some of them were.
And you
came to know which areas you could go into and who was friendly and who was not.
Mm-hmm.
But you learn that rather quickly.
Right.
But, that was a lot of, especially early on, there was a lot of infighting. We were actually, you know, the city of Najaf was where the El Salvadorians were.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you remember back when the kind of a moderate cleric was there, and he was killed in a car bomb.
Oh, right. That does sound familiar.
That was when Sauter took over.
Uh-huh, right.
And actually, we were across the street from that. That's where our base was.
Oh, okay.
Across the street when that happened. And you could see quite a change. He was actually trying to blame the U.S. for it, which the people would pretty much believe anything. I mean, you could tell them anything, and they would believe it, especially if it came from a cleric.
Right.
So that's what a lot of what you had to deal with. I mean, you know, you had to deal with. I mean, so, and after that, it kind of changed. And from that, you know, of course, I think we had left, that was later on in 04 when they actually went to war with Sauter over there.
Right.
With his army in the city of Najaf. But we were there from the first of it.
Okay.
But it was getting a little hairy back then with him. I think he was the one that was trying to take power.
Right.
Yeah, there was actually one time over there when they said, you know, of course everybody, all the soldiers wore sunglasses over there. And they put it out that the soldiers could actually see through your clothes with those sunglasses. that offended
right.
them because you were looking at their women, you were looking through their clothes over there.
Uh-huh. Right.
So, and we actually, there was a lot of little kids would always want to look at your sunglasses, you know.
Yeah.
You know, right. We'd get them, let them look through them, you know, and they'd look around. I guess they figured out, hey, you know, you really can't see through your clothes with these things.
But, yeah.
Wild.
Right. Were most of the kids pretty friendly then?
Yeah, all the kids were real friendly.
Uh-huh.
They kind of hung around and, you know, of course, you know, being soldiers, you'd give them stuff. You know,
right.
Food and whatever. They bring you stuff, you know.
Uh-huh.
Whatever you wanted, you could ask them for it. Which, you know, during that time, there was no beer allowed.
Right.
Of course. And of course, you could go to the kids and say, hey, go get me a case of beer. And they come back with a case of beer.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
But it was an experience. I mean, we pretty much went on the convoy with and slept, usually had cots with us, and we would just sleep wherever we were at that time, you know, sleep on the ground.
All right. Another thing you mentioned a little earlier, you talked about the Iraqi army. Did you guys have much interaction with them?
We had a little bit of interaction with them, not a whole lot.
Okay.
we didn't have any, you know, responsibility as far as training or anything like that. You know, we had a little bit of interaction with them around the different bases that we went to, and there were some being trained on one of the bases where we had coalition forces at.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a little bit of, I think there were some of them being trained by the Nicaraguans. Nicaraguans had the EOD mission for the multinationals. So I think they were training some over there.
Okay.
We had a little bit of interaction with them.
Right. All right. And you said your impression of them was much like the Iraqi people, that they couldn't really think for themselves?
The Iraqi army?
Yeah.
Yeah. For the most part, just the everyday soldier.
Uh-huh.
In other words, it took... I remember later on we had meetings with even officers and senior officers.
Uh-huh.
They just have they get hung up on a senior Iraqi officer thinks and tries to do stuff as in the U.S. Army that an NCO would be doing.
Uh-huh.
You know, they try to think of they get down in the weeds with little stuff and they're not looking at the big picture.
Right.
So I think that's one of the main things, and that's what the Army was trying to do, was trying to beef up the NCO Corps over there.
Okay.
Trying to get a cadre of NCOs that could actually take some of that pressure off, so that you had more of a U.S. Army chain of command.
Mm-hmm. All right. One question I meant to ask you a little bit earlier. How much, from your perspective, had the military changed since Vietnam?
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah. About 90 degrees, I guess.
Okay.
Well, I mean, one of the differences was, you know, as far as back when I was in during Vietnam, they could give a shit less for the soldier, in other words.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You were a draftee, or even if you volunteered, you were there, you were stuck. They could care less anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's like I told somebody, you know, if you want to see the vets from Vietnam that had the post-traumatic stress disorder, I said you can go visit either the prisons or either they're dead,
mm-hmm.
You know, because, you know, there was no care given to the soldiers coming out of Vietnam.
Right.
I mean, it was pretty much zero.
Right.
You know, now I think maybe because it's a popular war, or not popular, but maybe because it's all volunteer and you also have the National Guard involved, so the different states involved, but, I mean, there's all kind of programs or anything that, you know, the soldier can go to.
Mm-hmm. Right.
With that, so... You know, as far as that, it's changed completely.
Okay.
I mean, as far as living conditions, living conditions have, you know, improved 100%. As far as the pay, the pay is up there now, whereas it wasn't that much back during the Vietnam times,
mm-hmm.
even comparable to the year difference.
Right. All right. Well, based on your experience of experiencing Vietnam and Iraq, did you get the feeling then that the military and the American people in general had learned some of the lessons from Vietnam?
Well, you can actually see some of the lessons that were present during Vietnam that are present now. As
okay.
far as, you know, I think the normal... I guess you would say the people in the United States are they want to see something, their attention span is very short.
Right, right.
And I think that the longer a war goes on, the less support you have for it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not being flashed on television and you're seeing it all and everybody's involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
As it goes on longer, people tend to start getting into a different routine of doing something else, and it's something that happened long ago.
Right.
So your support is gone on there. You know, I've always, you know, think that has a lot to do with it, and I think that's where they lost support in Vietnam. And I don't think I can see it now as compared to back from 2003 when it started up until now with Afghanistan going on strong.
Uh-huh, right.
It seems to me that the support has gone down. I haven't seen any, you know, anything done as far as that to find out, but it just seems to me that the support is going down from when it is. And people just can't realize that, you know, a war is not going to be, it's not going to be like the first Gulf War. It's not going to be 80 days and it's finished.
Right.
We won.
Right.
You know, this is not what these are about.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right. All right. Well, anything else we should mention about your first tour in Iraq? Any other memorable moments that stick out in your mind?
Oh, gosh, I can't think of any.
Okay.
It was pretty much just, that was really the only one where I was actually kind of in the combat portion of it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, my other deployments, I guess my rank had gotten so where I wasn't able to do all of that.
Okay. Well, after the 2003 deployment, what did you do at that point? I know you didn't go back again until 06, but what were 06. You doing in the meantime?
Well, actually, I was still in still in the same unit then, which was the 226 ASG out of Mobile.
Okay.
We came back, of course, in 04, and, you know, all of those hurricanes we had down there. You said you were from Mobile.
Yeah, right? I'm from Mobile, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, all the hurricanes.
Okay.
So we worked all the hurricanes between... I forget how many we had. It was like three or four, I think.
The Ivan and Katrina.
We had Ivan, Katrina. There was a couple more, I think.
Yeah.
Close. But in Mobile, we were set up as which it continues to this day, but we're called Task Force South there at Fort Whiting.
Okay.
And we are actually the nerve centers of any of the hurricanes or anything that comes into that area.
Mm, okay.
So we coordinate all of the support from FEMA.
Right.
All the work with all the EMAs around there. It's actually, you know, we're actually supposed to be just for Alabama, but a lot of times we'll kind of coexist with some of the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
Especially Mississippi, we supported them a lot during Katrina.
Okay.
And even down into Louisiana.
Right.
But that's pretty much what we did when we got back.
All right.
Yeah, and then, of course, then they deployed the unit again in 2006.
Mm-hmm. Right. And when you got that, when you guys were redeployed, when you heard that you were going to be redeployed, what was your reaction to that?
Well, my reaction was, boy, I wonder what my wife's going to say.
Right.
We had the choice because they deployed us so quick,
mm-hmm.
which usually the units were getting about supposed to get about 4 years in between deployments.
Mm-hmm.
So after you got back, so that would have been like 2008 or something before.
Okay,
they could have got us again, but there was only I think a total of 14 people that actually went on the 2006 deployment.
Hmm.
That
okay.
were on the 2003 deployment.
Okay.
The rest of them opted not to go.
Right.
So at that time, I was asked if I would take over as the command sergeant major.
Okay.
For that, and so I went ahead. I took the command sergeant major, and I felt obligated. I had to go back because if I was going to take the rank, I was going to go with the unit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I ended up going back again with them.
Mm-hmm. All right. And where in Iraq did you go this time?
We were at in Al-Asad, which is in Anbar Province.
Okay. Yeah.
We were actually operational command from the 1st MEF again, 1st
okay.
Marine Expeditionary Force. That was a Marine base there at Aliside.
Mm-hmm.
And they got us as the, we were pretty much the garrison command for that base.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of Marines, mostly Marines there. We had some Army units. Some units were doing convoy all the way to the Jordanian and Syrian border where they were bringing in supplies.
Okay.
And it was, that was back when Anbar Province was pretty rough, too, back then.
Right.
So they usually led with the most deaths from IEDs and stuff. It was pretty bad.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, along those lines, I guess, how much did you notice that things had changed since your first deployment?
Well, yeah, a number of things had changed. I mean, as far as the, of course, I didn't have to go out on convoys or anything else. I was pretty much, you know, staying on base.
Uh-huh.
As a CSM, I didn't get to go anywhere. But as far as all the, you know, they gotten a whole lot, like, up-armored Humvees. You didn't even go off the base unless it was an up-armored Humvee. And that's when they first started getting the MRAPs. Out there, we were the first to get the MRAPs.
Okay.
Because of all the IEDs and stuff that we were having around there.
Right.
And, it was just a lot. A lot had improved as far as technology, as far as some of the systems that we had to counter the IEDs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We actually had a counter IED team that was there on base, and they tried to keep up with everything that was going on. It had gotten a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the living conditions, it had gotten a whole lot better than the first time I was over there.
Oh, really?
They actually had, yeah, they actually had trailers set up, and that's where we were housed.
Okay.
I guess the only difference was the water. We were kind of in a, what they call a wadi, fairly close to the Euphrates River.
Okay.
And that's where we got our main water supply, came from the Euphrates water. From the Euphrates River.
Right.
And there was a treatment plant that was, of course, it was outside the wire. It was in a Iraqi town. And we got water from there. We also had wells dug on in the wadi with water that we got from there, but it wasn't real good water. I mean, it had a lot of high sulfur content and everything else, and had to be purified and everything like that. So I guess when the Iraqis would get mad with us, they'd blow the water line up. So you'd be on water rations for a week.
Right.
To go out there and fix the water and all of that stuff. But we got rocketed a few times, but from where the base was, it was hard for them to actually get close enough to actually lay any accurate fire on the base.
Okay.
It was probably, I think it was one of the Navy's and Marine Corps. It was there. It was an air base. And I think it was one of the busiest that they had.
Oh, okay. All right. Could you talk, I guess, a little bit more about your specific duties during this tour?
Well, I was just the senior non-commissioned officer on base, other than the Marine Corps. So I pretty much had things to do with everything other than the Marine Corps unit. So I had all of the Army units. I was pretty much... had them, anybody else that came on base.
All right.
I worked with the Marine Corps Sergeant Majors.
Okay.
And so we worked together, and anything that happened, we would just, we never had any problems. I worked well with them.
Mm-hmm.
We got along great. And but anything that happened, you know, that had to do with any of the Army units on there, they would go through me.
Right. Okay.
So.
All right. Was this a year-long deployment?
Yeah, it was actually longer than a year.
Okay.
Yeah, I was actually, the whole deployment was, I think it was 16 months. That was, we got kind of caught up in that when they were extending everybody. So we got kind of caught up in it.
Okay. All right. Well, any memorable moments from this deployment that stick out?
Not really. It was just a routine deployment. The unit that went over there, we pretty much just had to grab people from all over the state of Alabama. I mean, they came from everywhere because, of course, you know, with only 14 of the original unit that went over there. So I guess that was, of course, we had some of the best that came from the state of Alabama, so we did a very good job over there. Mm-hmm. I mean, what we had to do.
Right. All right. Along those lines, I've heard some critics in the media and stuff say that multiple deployments by the National Guard units damaged them in some ways, weakened morale, ground them down, kind of thing. Is there any truth to that from your perspective?
I don't really think so. I mean, you have so many people that are, I guess it's because the economy is so bad, they just go from one deployment to the next.
Okay.
I mean, I've had some that were on this last deployment came to me trying to find, to see who I knew so they could get on another deployment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's actually some of them's job now, going
right.
from one deployment to the next.
Mm. Right.
I mean, as far as grinding them down, I don't really think so. I think, you know, they give, you get quite a bit of a time off when you get back.
Right.
I think it's probably different from what type unit that you're going over there with.
Okay.
I'm sure it would be a little different in morale, grinding down and everything else if you were like an MP unit, actually having to get on the ground doing things, and or with an infantry unit that had to go, you know, door to door, kicking in doors and stuff.
Right.
You know, the combat units, I'm sure, would be have a tendency to get, you know, kind of ground down. But the thing is, I mean, you know, the National Guard has met its strength every month, and I think they're 100% now. So, I mean, you know, if it's grinding it down, then apparently, you know, you got people signing up to go.
Right.
So, I'm not really sure what they're criticizing there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, another question I have for you. I know that 2006, 2007, this deployment was a pretty bad time in Iraq and what was going on at that time. But by the time you returned in 2009, 2010, the surge had already taken place.
Right.
And so had things improved much from your perspective that for that last time? Could you see a difference?
Oh, that was a big difference. I mean, it was just a complete turnaround.
Okay.
We didn't, of course, we were based in Kuwait then, so we didn't have a whole lot to do with Iraq.
Okay.
With the unit I was in, we had most of the northern camps that were in Kuwait, and we had units coming through going to Iraq, and we also had, we were attached to a brigade out of Wyoming who actually did the convoys up into northern Iraq and back. So we knew what was going on as far as convoys, and there was very little activity. Just an occasional IED, an occasional sniper, and they were just around in certain areas. I mean, other than that, it's gotten very safe over there. I don't think the brigade actually, our company lost one soldier, and I don't think the brigade lost any in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
We lost one soldier because of an accident.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I think they had a couple that were, I think they had one guy that was shot. A lot of them, I think there was a couple that went through IEDs. But other than that, everything was, you know, pretty good.
Right. All right. Do you want me to stop for a moment?
No, yeah, hold on. That's okay.
All right. Okay. Well, this last deployment, what were your duties at this time?
Well, I came back when I came back, and I went back to Mobile as the command sergeant major, and you know, I knew my ETS getting out and retiring was around 2010.
Okay.
We got back, and the ASG, the Air Support Group, changed over to what they call a maneuver enhancement brigade with combat units under it, which I kind of liked anyway, being combat.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a, which I'm not, you know, there was a a difference. There was a new general. We fell under troop command, and there was a new general came in there. And she decided that she wanted to change things up, so she was going to send me from Mobile all the way to Decatur. She wanted me to take over as a CSM for a unit up in Decatur.
Mm, okay.
Which, my gosh, you know, that's another. It's quite, you know, from one end of the state to the other, which
right.
I didn't quite agree with, you know, but there wasn't a whole lot I could do about it. You know, it's like I told her, you know, hey, you're the general, you make the decisions. And
right.
I either go along with them or I get out, one of the two.
Right.
So that's what she's going to do. So I just decided that since I didn't have but like a year left, you know, before I retired, I might as well go for another deployment. So I called him up and told him I'd just then go to another deployment to see what was out there.
Yeah. Right.
So I actually wanted to go to Afghanistan, and I was going to go on a, what they call it, ETT team, you know, embedded trainer team.
Okay.
Over to Afghanistan, but the times didn't work out, and I really couldn't get it. So then this actual deployment was the only one that came up. And they had a slot open for a operations sergeant major.
Okay.
Which has to do with all of the operations that you know, you handle all of the operations that come in. In other words, you're kind of the nerve center.
Mm, right.
You know, like a command center, and you just handle anything that comes up. So I told them I would go ahead and take that one then. So
yeah.
That's how I ended up there.
Right.
But I was responsible for any of the operations going on. We had different sections under us. We had border operations with Kuwait and Iraq. We just had oversight of all the units that came through. That's a big training base where we were on.
Okay.
Training all the units before they go to Iraq.
Right.
And of course, it's mostly run by contractors, but we have oversight on that. And so we had something to do with all the life support that was on the base. We dealt a lot with contracts and stuff and civilian contractors.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we were kind of the military oversight for those contractors. And I did all the operations. Anything that needed to be done was run through us.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Kind of like a 911 for the base, I guess.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
That's pretty much what I did. Never knew what I was going to do from one day to the next. Of course, that's fine with me. I like it like that.
Right. Right.
Something different.
Mm-hmm. All right. How long did this deployment last? Was it a year or?
Yeah, we actually, from April 15th, 2009, we actually came back, we deployed out of Fort Hood, and we actually came back in, March, I think it was in March, we came back a little early.
Okay.
We were over there. Now the National Guard has a policy where from the day that a unit is activated, they can only stay for 1 year.
Okay.
So if you stay somewhere and you train up for 2 months, then, you know, that just gives you 10 months in country.
Mm, right.
So rather than before, it was 1 year boots on the ground, which meant after all of your training, whatever, your first day for 1 year was when you set foot in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's changed.
Right. All right. Well, anything else about this last deployment we should mention?
No, I can't think of anything.
Okay. All right. Have you retired at this point? Or?
No, I haven't yet. I'm still on active duty, so
okay.
Don't say anything to get me in trouble.
Right.
I actually my retirement date is July 19th, which is my birthday, and I'll turn 60
okay.
years old.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my retirement date.
Right.
When I got back, they owed me 125 days of leave, so
uh-huh.
I've actually been on leave ever since.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, before wrapping up the interview, if I could ask you, I usually wrap the interviews up asking some broad questions regarding Vietnam.
Yeah.
Just to kind of close things out. But Looking back, excuse me, looking back on your experiences in Vietnam, how do you feel about your service in Vietnam and American involvement in Vietnam?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm proud of my service over there, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I always have been, you know. It's just like, it just seems kind of funny, you know, when you, and the difference of me and a lot of the veterans that aren't still in,
mm-hmm.
is it's kind of, I don't know, when you come back from Iraq or whatever and there's all these parades and everything else, you know, it's just, I kind of think back, you know, it would have been great if the Vietnam veterans had had that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's just so much of a difference in that, you know, an attitude of people from Vietnam veterans to now.
Right.
As far as that, you know, American involvement, I don't know if it did any good.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of wars are probably fought for the wrong things, and most of them are fought for economic gains.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to kid ourselves all the time because we worked, you know, worked and fought on the Michelin rubber plantation.
Right.
Down at Three Corps.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was, it's just part of it, I guess, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, wars are fought for different things, you know.
Right.
As far as my service over there, you know, I was proud of my service over there.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned about coming home this, you know, since Iraq and all, and there being parades and public support. How did that feel? In some ways, finally getting this when it's something that most of the guys that you served with in Vietnam never experienced that. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, it was pretty emotional, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So.
Right.
Other than that, it's just,
mm-hmm.
you know, I guess it brings up old thoughts, you know.
Mm-hmm. Sure. All right. All right. Let's see. Well, again, with Vietnam, looking back on it, how did you feel about, I don't know, I guess things like the media coverage of the war in Vietnam? Did you give much thought to that?
Well, of course, like now you have embedded reporters and everything. We never had one over there. In
mm-hmm.
fact, I never saw a reporter over there.
Okay.
You know, I would assume they wouldn't embed them with a small team like us, but
right.
we didn't have a whole lot of interaction with them at all from mm-hmm. where we operated out of. I don't
okay.
think they would probably allow them to go that far forward
mm-hmm.
and everything. I remember, I think I was over there when they had the Kent State, where they killed, the National Guard killed those soldiers, I mean the students over there.
Right.
And, you know, we got the Stars and Stripes over there, and everything was pretty much, they censored everything over there.
Right.
Email, whatever, you know, which they don't do now.
Yeah.
And I remember not really knowing what happened at Kent State till we got back to the States.
Mm.
You know, there's
right.
a lot of stuff you didn't find out till you got back.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of stuff that happened over there that not, you know, it never got out into the media.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, along the lines of Kent State and the likes of that, what did you think of about the war protests and the protest movement in general?
Well, I mean, you know, I never participated in it or anything like
uh-huh,
that.
Sure.
I felt like really, I'm not really sure if they were really sincere in that,
mm-hmm.
More than they were just wanting to do it to, you know, go against the establishment. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that
sure.
the war was actually in some of them's mind. I think it was just more of a, hey, you know, follow the pack, you know, let's protest the war.
Mm-hmm. So more of a, not a actual protest against the war based on moral feelings or anything like that, just wanting to kind of go against the establishment. You think also some of it could have been not wanting to actually serve themselves?
It's possible. you know, it possibly could. you know, I don't really know, but right. Of course, a lot of them did, you know.
Yeah.
In which, you know, you take, you know, Jane Fonda, for instance, going over there, you know, mm-hmm. somebody like her.
Right.
You know, that's just.
Yeah. All right.
I kind of liked it when I read it. She was signing her book, and a Vietnam vet went and spit in her face. I thought that was pretty nice.
Right.
Congratulating.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, what's your opinion of, I guess, modern-day Vietnam and U.S. policy towards Vietnam, this developing relationship that we have with them with trade and tourism and things like that?
I don't see any reason they shouldn't. I think they should open up trade and everything else. I have nothing against the Vietnamese people.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's no different. And I mean, they're a lot better than some of the other countries that we trade with.
Okay.
I mean, you know.
Right.
I see no reason why we don't.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right.
So.
Well, I know in recent years, the last, I guess, 10, 15 years or so, a lot of Vietnam veterans have gone back to Vietnam. Have you ever given any thought to that?
I really haven't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing is, if you know, I've watched some of them on television where they went back to different places and different fire bases and stuff like that.
Right.
I would have no idea where any of the stuff where I was,
uh-huh.
where it is, because I mean. We went to so many different places, and most of our places were, you know, most of my time was spent in the jungle. We didn't spend any time back in the rear. I mean, we just went from firebase to firebase,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't tell you where any of them are.
Right.
You know.
All right.
Which I guess, you know, I don't really, I mean, it's actually probably, you know, it's a beautiful place in parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, it wouldn't be a bad place to take a vacation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
All right. All right. Last few questions. Another one. Have you ever visited the Vietnam Wall? And if so, what did you think of it?
No, I never have.
Okay.
No. I have thought about going. Yeah, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything else we should cover? Anything else we haven't mentioned at this point?
I can't think of anything.
All right.
I appreciate it.
All right. Well, I appreciate it as well, Mr. Ray. Let me go ahead and stop the...